Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is MacBreak Weekly, episode 204, recorded July 20th, 2010. Bumper Money. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Carbonite. Backing up files on your PC or Mac is safe and easy with Carbonite. For a free trial plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com. Offer code MacBreak. And by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to Audible.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show that covers all your Mac needs in one easy-to-consume bundle here with us today. I'm so glad to have him on, John Gruber from DaringFireball.net, the quintessential Mac blogger. Hey, John.
Hey, Leo.
Good to have you. The grumpy Macker.
Oh, no, I'm a nice guy.
I know, it's funny. You're so happy-go-lucky. But then sometimes on the blog, sometimes you seem like you're a little grumpy.
Yeah, maybe I should add smileys or something.
There you go. That'd help. Also here, man, is all smiles. It is now beautifully lit solarium.
Yes.
I love it. Andy Inoko from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth. Hello, Andy.
Thank you very much. I've been reminded that back when I didn't care what the office and the studio looked like, my life was so much easier.
Yeah.
I could go out to breakfast on Tuesday morning.
A lot of work. But now this is a set, right? This is not, you actually don't have any windows to the outside where you are incarcerated.
No, and unfortunately I couldn't afford the green screen, so this is just a matte painting. I hired some ex-ILM guys to just paint me a huge backyard thing.
It's very realistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have two guys at a table there with like those kind of squeezy things that make bird sounds.
Oh,
so we'll hopefully
cool.
See. This is costing me a lot of money. So if we don't hear a lot of interruptions from the background, I'm going to be really, really steamy. That's all I'm saying.
For those who are curious, somebody's asking in the chat room, you have a camcorder that you use. We sent you, I think, an HV40, a Canon HV40.
The Canon HV40, yes.
Yeah. And that does give you the nice thing on the Mac, you got the FireWire in.
HV40 right. Is I mean, it takes a while to get it dialed in, but also you can do things
Ooh,
like
the daring eyeball.
Yes. So, I mean, if I don't want you to see like that, I'm taking a sip of tea or something here. I can just make it fun for all of us, and just so you're focusing just on my eyes.
Can't
here.
See the lettuce in your teeth.
Yeah, this instantly feels a lot more dramatic. It's a
it
little
does.
Bit,
look at the giant Inotko over my shoulder.
Yeah. It's almost Hitchcockian.
Well, there's a couple of things going on today. Actually, the big story today is Apple will announce its quarterly results, its quarterly earnings. Of course, as always, they like to wait till after we get off the air before they do anything of import, afraid that we might report on it. But it looks probably to be pretty good, despite, and please don't kick me, John, Antenna Gate. all
well,
signs-
that wouldn't be reflected in this quarter anyway.
I guess it wouldn't. And, iPhone sales would be or would not be? I guess they missed the quarter, did they?
When was the end of the quarter? It must have been...
End of June.
Yeah.
Mostly we're looking at how the iPad affected sales of desktop Macs and sales of iPod Touches and that sort of stuff.
Will this be
I think it's like almost like 3 years ago where the first few days of iPhone 4 sales will be...
What the hell? Those
that
ILM
cost
people
me
just went
$18. You can get any time you can get the Blue Angels to fly over your podcast. Bit pricey, but you know what? We're getting now that we have that Netflix Roku streaming deal. There's some money coming in.
And I really appreciated the missing man formation. I'm sorry we didn't get to the shot soon enough to see it.
Well, that's for Alex Lindsay, who was away this week.
Thank you for reminding me. Alex is in he's in Pennsylvania. He's in your neck of the woods, John. Doing some training, couldn't break away, but we're very pleased to have John Gruber. Chris Breen is in Hawaii. Everybody's out of town, basically. It's that time of year, not unusual. So the quarterly results we'll hear about by the time you are listening to this, you'll already know. But it looks to be that Microsoft perhaps will overtake Microsoft
in terms of revenue for the quarter, which is, you know, earlier their stock price meant that their stock market value anyway was greater than Microsoft. Now their revenue, which is predicted to be somewhere around $13 to $13.5 billion, will exceed Microsoft's. That's kind of amazing.
It is amazing, but the real part, you know, business is profit, not revenue.
True.
And Microsoft is still the by far and away the most profitable company in the industry.
Because they sell bits, which cost nothing to make.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Almost everything they sell is software, and software has a higher margin than hardware.
As usual.
But you know, the graph is very interesting if you look at the trend, that if it keeps up, you know, it's not inconceivable that Apple will pass them in profit.
I should say Apple will overtake Microsoft. Apparently, right. I said Microsoft will overtake Microsoft, which would be, I think, an impossibility, like Ouroboros eating its own tail. Analysts say a poll by Reuters says Apple is expected to report around. Apple predicted $13 to $13.5 billion. That was Apple's own prediction. As usual, they sandbag the analysts, going low and coming out high. Analysts expect $14.6 billion in revenue, $2.85 billion in net income. Microsoft expected to do $15 billion and $4.1 billion in $15 billion in revenue and $4.1 billion in net income. I've never been good with numbers. This will be the first quarter to reflect sales of the iPad. So we'll be now. They don't usually reveal sales numbers, do they? Just revenue.
Well, Apple's usually very proud to say how many they're selling per week, so I think that they should have no problem figuring out how many iPads got sold.
Yes. Any predictions there? 4 million? 5 million? A billion?
I don't know. I think that one analyst was saying that in terms of how the effects of the iPad, I think they're saying that they actually sold more desktops, more Mac OS devices in that quarter than they did the quarter before, the year before. So the big question that I was curious about when we get the actual news from Apple is, are people buying iPads instead of MacBooks?
Right.
And this analyst seems to think that, no, the numbers are going to reflect that for some reason people are still buying Mac OS devices. So everyone wins.
I'm going to cheat, Leo. Here's how I'm going to cheat. So you guys have heard of Andy Zaki? His last name is Z-A-K-Y. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's Zaki or Zaki. But he's sort of an unaffiliated analyst. And you know, if you track these guys over the quarters, this guy has Apple nailed. I mean, this guy's record speaks, you know, is unbelievable.
What is Zaki saying?
So his weblog is bullcross.blogspot.com. And he's got his earnings preview. And so I'm just going to cheat and I'm going to steal his predictions.
Okay.
So he predicts from Macintosh, he predicts 3.37 million and he predicts 3.4 million iPads. So, you know, his prediction is pretty much about 3.4 million Macs, 3.4 million iPads.
That's great. I mean, if you think of a company that was, you know, happy with the sales of its computers, introduces a new product and it does as well as the computers, you know, out of the box, that's phenomenal. It's just doubling your sales out of the box.
And here's the other interesting thing. So there's those IDC numbers that come out every quarter with market share, right? So everybody seems to have agreed the iPad is not a PC, so it doesn't count towards PC market share, right? But on the other hand, everybody's also worried, well, is it going to make people not buy MacBooks? You know, so maybe if you added them together, you'd have Apple. If you do count the iPad as a computer, then Apple is selling close to 7 million computers a quarter.
Impressive.
Which would totally put it at a different spot on that list of you know, computer makers.
Right.
I'm not sure if they'd be number one, if they'd be ahead of Dell or what, but I guess HP's number one. But
there's no question that the mobile,
be a lot closer.
The iOS devices are just huge for Apple's bottom line. And
I mean, if you had a device that was exactly the same as the iPad physically, but it was running Mac OS X, it would count as a computer. So it's a question of does the fact that it runs iOS put it in a different category. I mean,
it's a computer, right?
That's what I think. But that just shows how those old definitions are sort of going away.
You can't fit them in the boxes anymore.
Right.
I mean, it is a low price computer. It's a $500 to $800 or $900 computer. Do you think the margins are good? Do you think that Apple must make more still on the computers and laptops? Must make a lot more on the computers and laptops.
Yeah, I think they're. The Sorry. I was struggling for actual numbers, but then realizing that the numbers that I have on how much money they're making on each unit is about 9 to 10 months old. So I really shouldn't talk about it. But yeah, the most conservative teardowns would say that an iPad, they make about a half to a third as much money on as each desktop.
Okay.
But it's kind of remarkable, though, when you think about how much more money they're getting from people for each shot out of a desktop than from an iPad. I mean, an iPad is not quite an impulse purchase at $500, but it's a little bit more. And also, it's as a unique item that has immense initial release hype behind it. I don't think it's quite that dramatic an accomplishment to be selling that much money in iPads versus here is the 18th edition of our portable Macintosh, and we're still selling more this quarter than we did last quarter.
Right.
We'll have 1 week of iPhone 4 sales, but I think everybody agrees the iPhone 4 is going to add considerably to the bottom line. And when you combine the two portable devices together, I think that they probably equal Mac sales. We've talked before, and I'd like to give John a chance to because you weren't here when we talked before, about the notion that Apple is paying more attention now to these iOS devices and less attention to OS X devices. Do you think we're seeing a diminution, or is Apple able to pay attention to both? Are you worried that the Mac computers are going to be a weak second to the portable devices, John?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a shade of gray type problem. I mean, I don't think it's black and white like, well, either they are hell-bent on the Mac or they've completely dropped the Mac. It's, you know, but the Mac has definitely shifted into a shade of gray area where it's, you know, it's obviously, I mean, I don't think, you don't even have to be a expert observer of the company to say that it's, you know, it's not the shining star of the company anymore,
right.
But it's still important. I mean, but you look at things like the fact that the Mac Pro hasn't been updated in, I think, 400 and some days.
We've been waiting for the new, I can't remember the chip, the 6-core chip in this thing forever.
Right. So it's, you know, it's a little weird, but I think it's sort of, I don't really think it's so much that Apple isn't as interested in the Mac as that this is Apple's estimation of how important PC hardware is to the industry at large, you know, that they sort of see it as a market where it's, what's the word for it? Like it's set and, you know, this is how it is. This is how PCs are. And so innovation isn't as important there because there just isn't that much room for it.
It's kind of almost an incremental market at this point for Apple.
Right, right.
I think it's more of a case where desktops and notebooks are a highly established field to mine money out of. They basically said, well, what if we go to this other continent over here and see what resources we can strip off of that land instead? And that's what they're doing with the iOS devices. It's a device. It's a market where they can essentially define what success is. They can define what the product's going to be, and essentially bring all this new money into the marketplace instead of this, especially now that it's July and August. This is the traditional season in which everybody goes to the stores with $500 to $1,500 in their hands to buy a notebook for school. And that's always been a fixed part of the market that season, that time, every single year. Now we also have this place where people will find an extra $500 for an iPad, or they'll find an extra $200 for this handheld device that they would not have wanted to purchase before. So I think it's just as much a question of building a brand new market as it is being content that they're still making money off of the old technology.
Yeah,
right. I mean, like, just take a look at the iPhone. You know, the iPhone 4 versus the iPhone 3GS. I mean, it's a, you know, pretty remarkable 1 year over the last year, 12 months later difference. There's no way that they could make a MacBook Pro, no matter how focused they were on it, no matter if they'd had everybody in the company all focus on making a new MacBook Pro or a new MacBook Air or something like that. They couldn't make one that 12 months after last year's models is that much better.
Right.
I mean, the you know.
Well, we're seeing that in general. I mean, we talked about this on Twitter on Sunday. All the innovation in technology right now is being focused absolutely on cell phones. And that's where all the excitement is happening.
Yeah, but that's because I think the customers haven't really insisted that we know exactly what we want in this sort of a device. They're still open to new ideas. At this point, the roles of a notebook and the roles of a desktop have been so firmly set that if you were to deviate markedly from that place, the people who count on this to not as an exciting new tech toy or an exciting new consumer product, but just as that boring device that helps them get through their workday and make their money and go home, that will frighten people a lot more than a brand new cell phone or a brand new tablet device.
Well, that's kind of what the iPad was, wasn't it? It was a redefining and reinvention of what...
Right.
A portable device is or a computer. And look at what Dell's doing. That this week they announced they're going to start shipping that 5-inch tablet that they've been talking about for some time. That's neat. I don't know what that is. It's neither here nor there. It's a 5-inch display, which is an oddball
Dell,
size.
Yeah, the Dell Streak.
The Streak, yeah.
Yeah, it's been available in the UK for a while. And it's just
oh, it has? Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
O2 got it, I don't know, a few months ago. But it's been out for a couple months now.
Sadly, it'll be AT&T here.
Yeah, but that'll be an interesting test.
One more thing to bog down the AT&T network.
Right. Well, no, I just mean an interesting test. I've been saying all along that we don't really... The iPad has not completely proven itself yet because it is so new and it is a brand new type of device that has never really existed before. So we don't know yet what it is that people are gravitating towards. If you need a device that's that big, if you need software that's that sophisticated, on and on and on. It's kind of like when the first digital cameras came aboard and every single new camera that came out had a different shape and a different size and a different form factor and a different set of features because the market had not yet said, this is what we want a digital camera to be. This is how we would want to use it. So this is an exciting time, at least for the next year and a half, when they finally come out with an iPad-like device, only something that's small enough you can actually stick in a back pocket. You don't need to carry it like a clipboard. Is that going to be as successful as an iPad? Is the size of the iPad a hindrance? Or is it literally everyone is saying, no, we really love that big screen? So... I think the interesting part of the showdown, though, is going to be that this is going to be running. It's Dell, so it's going to be running Android.
Right.
HP is getting into tablets, but they're going to be using their new Palm WebOS that they bought when they bought the company a few months ago. And if there was ever an operating system that could compete with iOS as a touch operating system, it would probably be WebOS and not Android.
Great article in Wired magazine today on the checkered history between Apple and AT&T and really how tense it's been since day one. You wrote up a little blurb on Daring Fireball.
Fred Vogelstein wrote the story. Really, really, it seemed like some fantastic reporting.
Great reporting.
Really got some good sourcing.
I'm going to go yell at Ralph is the quote that you pulled. Steve Jobs saying he you know how upset he was with AT&T.
Well, and specifically that quote where it's he talked to somebody in the room, that was in the context of what it was like in December. It was after, so in June 2009, I guess, a year ago, when Apple first announced tethering support in the OS, and they said, here's the carriers around the world that will support it this summer, and AT&T is not on the list, and everybody in the room is like, and then it was December, so it's like 6 months after Apple had already put the support of it in the OS, and Ralph, what's his last name? De La Vega, whatever his name is.
He's the new CEO.
He gets up on stage. They're still in negotiations with Apple, but he gets up on stage and says it's coming soon, even though they haven't done it. And that's what set Jobs off, is that he got up there and put effective, because when Ralph... De La Vega says something like that. He's effectively speaking for Apple and AT&T.
Right.
And it wasn't a done deal, and he was like, I'm going to go call Ralph.
I'm going to yell at Ralph. but AT&T not so happy with Apple either, according to this article, blaming Apple's buggy baseband software for some of the problems that they were experiencing. It seems like it was I think we always kind of knew that this was maybe a difficult relationship, but according to this article, the great reporting from Fred Vogelstein, it's really been rockier than anybody really imagined.
Yeah, and the article actually does the impossible. It actually gives you a little bit of sympathy for AT&T's position because his reporting was talking to from AT&T's position. They're never a company that's Apple. to make up an example would be a company that says, oh, by the way, we're going to be making a new iPhone that's the size and width of a number two pencil. And if AT&T says, there is no way that we can network support it, they'll say, tough, we build the phones, you build the networks. If it's a problem with your network, then you should solve it.
Right.
And say, but it's the size of a pencil. Your bike, people are idiots.
Right. And also, apparently, from day one, Apple was actively considering splitting with AT&T just months after the iPhone launched. I'm quoting here from the article. And not long after Rin asked Apple to limit YouTube usage. This is another story where early on AT&T said, could you just please have the YouTube videos stop after 30 seconds or...
The Wi-Fi.
Make them use, please, because you're killing us here. And Apple's response is no, just no. And they said, well, we'll escalate this to our executive suite. And Apple said, well, we'll escalate this to Steve Jobs. Who's going to win?
Yeah.
And AT&T went away with its tail between its legs. So shortly after that, according to this article, quote, Jobs was investigating another possible solution, dropping AT&T, dropping, not merely splitting it, but dropping AT&T and striking a deal with Verizon. The problem was, of course, CDMA and the CDMA chip and designing a phone that had a CDMA chip instead of a GSM chip. But apparently, Scott Forstall went to Qualcomm, which makes a CDMA chip, and investigated this. But in the end, they decided just too complicated and expensive to do it. However, they said there were at least six documented cases of Apple investigating a switch to Verizon. It's a must read article. If you're at all interested in it, it's a great soap opera.
Yeah. Not only that, it's just, he got those really wonderful, like little quotes and little stories about how like some AT&T low level flunky was talking to some of the counterpart at Apple. And he actually suggested, oh, by the way, when Steve Jobs meets our board of directors, he should probably wear a suit.
Oh,
like, oh, for God's sake.
The response was apparently, we're Apple. We don't even own suits. Which I love that response.
And you know what else is funny, too? And it wasn't mentioned in the article, but on the AT&T board of directors is Gil Amelio.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. That's got it. There is no love lost between Steve and Gil, of course.
Oh, to have been a fly on the wall.
Yeah. Hello, Gil. and Amelio even had the gall at one point to say, everything Steve Jobs did for Apple, I had put in place already. It was my idea, he basically said. So, yeah, I can only imagine. Any other? I'm just looking through the article, see if there's any other juicy tidbits. It is an absolute must read. He points out the hashtag ATT fail and its checkered history on Twitter. Every time anything happens with AT&T or Apple, the hashtag raises its ugly head once again. For both companies, it's been a huge commercial success, as difficult as it's been for both of them. He's quick to point out that at least short term, it's a financial success. iPhone represents more than $13 billion in annual revenue for Apple. And it has been incredible for AT&T since the iPhone came out. AT&T's wireless revenue is up 43%, profits up 200%, subscribers have grown 40%. And you can clearly point to the iPhone for all of this. And yet, he says, the true cost to AT&T of this exhausting relationship, this is Fred Vogelstein writing, will be debated for years. It's true that AT&T has suffered in its reputation greatly from this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they can't be happy about it, because every time that something good is going on with the iPhone, it's always a testimony to Apple and to Steve Jobs and innovation and to design and to we love our users. And everything bad, it just gets swept towards AT&T.
I do have to point out, though, that Steve on Friday showed some real forbearance. He didn't. John, correct me if I'm wrong, but he didn't mention AT&T. He didn't blame. He could have easily blamed AT&T.
No, no, no. He did mention him, but I thought he only mentioned them in a positive context.
Right.
I thought that his...
He bent over backwards, in fact, it seemed.
Yeah, and you know, I went there, you know, we can talk about that. You know, I mean, you probably have a segment planned on it, but I went there...
No, let's talk now. That's good. You were there.
Yeah, I was there. And I went there thinking it could be anything, you know. I mean, it effectively went off, you know, more or less... with them saying, here's why the iPhone 4 antenna is actually just fine. You know, that it's not perfect, but, you know, and it has this problem with touching it down here. But
don't overall, touch me there.
It's good. So more or less, that's sort of what I expected. But I thought it could be anything, though. What if they have determined that either all of them, which I think is very unlikely, given how many iPhone 4s, I mean, mine personally and many other people I've talked to that just don't have a problem with this. But what if there was a subset of them that did have a hardware defect? So if your serial numbers were in this range, maybe there would be a recall, which would be huge news. And I also thought, just as a wild card, what if Jobs concluded that it's AT&T's fault insofar as it's only with mediocre to spotty coverage that you run into that it drops far enough to be a problem when you touch it wrong? And what if that's it? And he was going to say, look, the iPhone's, I know we only released this damn thing a month ago, but we're going to Verizon and we're announcing it. And the reason they announced it in a hurry was to do it within the 30-day return period for AT&T, right? Did I expect that? Would I have bet on it? No way. I mean, it would have been a bombshell. I would not have bet on it. But would I have put it past him? Does that sound totally un-Steve Jobs-like to do that? I thought, you know, I better be there.
It could have happened. You're absolutely right. It could have been a huge
story.
But at
the actual event, I would say that Steve Jobs did not sound like a man who's planning to
drop AT&T.
Drop AT&T soon.
And I have to say, Verizon's not acting like a company that wants the iPhone at this point.
Right. And the most interesting thing he said about AT&T by far, and it's almost like, how did this not come out before if it's literally true, is he was talking about the problems that AT&T has improving reception in certain areas. And he said, if they want to put a new cell tower in at Texas, on average, it takes about 3 weeks. In the city of San Francisco, due to how crowded it is and due to the complicated urban zoning restrictions, it takes on average 3 years to add one new cell tower in San Francisco. And so you think about that. The iPhone's only been out for 3 years. So whatever, if that's literally true, that it takes about 3 years to add a cell tower in San Francisco, whatever changes AT&T wants to make to their coverage in San Francisco because of the iPad or iPhone, we're literally only going to start seeing now because the iPhone only came out 3 years ago.
Would it be smart for Verizon at this point to, or any other phone company, to say, we don't want the iPhone because of the potential black eye? I mean, right now, you can blame AT&T. It's easy to blame AT&T. But what if another company like Verizon comes along, has the same problems? Then you start saying, well, you know, maybe it's these companies don't have enough bandwidth for a heavy bandwidth use. And certainly there's no question that iPhone users use bandwidth at a rate far greater than any other phone. I don't know about these new Android phones. I wonder. I would bet it's comparable on phones like the Droid X or the Evo.
Verizon would have an advantage that AT&T didn't, which is to craft a rate plan for iPhone users with knowledge of how iPhone users use the network. Yeah. So I really have no doubt that Verizon would love to. Right now, they do correctly a bunch of commercials that say that we have the most reliable and the broadest network. They would love to also say, and we have the hottest phones out there.
Right.
The other big difference Verizon has over AT&T is AT&T went into this, obviously, with a low ball estimate
based on
how much they thought that people were going to use it. They really they really didn't think iPhone users were going to use much more data than other phone makers. And maybe Apple told them, no, dude, you should be ready for this. People are going to love this. People are going to use it. And AT&T obviously didn't believe it. Verizon, though, surely has a pretty good idea of how much data the average iPhone user uses on AT&T. And so whatever, you know, if it ever comes to pass, I think they're going to have a pretty good idea of what they're in for.
Exactly.
But they have the same problem in San Francisco that AT&T does. They don't get towers up any faster. Does CDMA have an advantage in data that GSM does not? I don't know. I'm not technical.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't think so, but
I want to talk more about the press conference. You were there, John. Andy and I were watching closely from afar, and AntennaGate, and whether what Apple did was enough, sufficient, better than sufficient. We have lots more to talk about. You're watching Mac Break Weekly. John Gruber is here from DaringFireball.net, the Apple blog to read, as everyone well knows. Andy Iannocco, also from the Chicago Sun-Times. Alex Lindsay has the week off. I'm Leo Laporte, and I'm here to tell you today about Carbonite Backup. If you are a user, Mac user, you have data. And if you have data on hard drives, I don't care if it's solid state drives or spinning drives, internal or external, you're at risk. Those drives will die at some point or other. And that's why I say use Carbonite. That's why I back it up. I just got Abby a 13-inch MacBook for college. She's going to college in about 3 weeks. And you better believe, first thing I did is I put Carbonite on it. She doesn't even need to know. The point is that if anything should happen, she could log on to any computer at school and get her data back. She can even use the iPhone or the BlackBerry apps. Those are free. And get her data back. Carbonite.com. That's something no local backup can do. And, of course, backing up off-site is very important in case the worst happens. Everything gets stolen. There's a fire, a flood, a tornado, or an earthquake, and you lose your backups. If they're sitting right next to the computer, you have to have off-site backup, too. Carbonite does it so easily. Go to Carbonite.com right now. Use the offer code MacBreak. You could try it free for 15 days. I just got an email from an Australian saying, hey, mate, we've got 30 days here in Australia. All right, you get 30 days there in Australia. But try it. Do try it for free because it does use your broadband, so you have to have a broadband connection. You'll be glad to see it doesn't slow down either your connection or your computer. It's very smart technology that watches and makes sure you're not using the system when it's backing up, but always in the background. It's keeping you backed up so you can always get your personal data back. And it's unlimited, by the way. Everything on your internal drive, all that personal data on your internal drive for less than $5 a month. Plus, if you use MacBreak, you'll get your first 2 months free, or I guess 2 months out of the first year free. Carbonite.com, offer code MacBreak. It's just backup done right. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it with Carbonite. And I don't want to hear any complaints. So, John, you were there. You know, I wonder, this whole thing reminded me, I kept using the word Nixonian, the word antenna gate, which Computer World coined, but Steve Jobs highlighted, the blaming of the media, the saying it's not our problem, but we're going to take care of it. But even the fact that I have a feeling people who were in the audience seeing it live might have had a different experience from those of us who were outside kind of watching the live blogs. What was your sense in the room?
I think it was a sense of frustration, you know. I mean, I kind of had the under the current sense that that Apple was sort of a gamble call as to whether they needed to do it. Like, what if they hadn't called the press conference, right? What if they hadn't? Would we still be talking about the iPhone 4 antenna this week? You know, I mean, obviously it was, I think what precipitated the whole thing was the Consumer Reports follow-up that said.
Absolutely.
And hear me out. Now, this is, it's one of those like butterfly flapping its wings in China type things. But so people made the videos where you can put your finger on the thing and you know, lose some bars. And it seemed to have gone away, right? And the thing that really rejuvenated it was the Consumer Reports follow-up. And the headline said, this is why Consumer Reports can't recommend the iPhone 4. Now, in Consumer Reports lingo, if you're a Consumer Reports reader, recommended is like their stamp of approval, right? It's a very specific meaning for them, you know, that something is recommended or it's not. And what they really meant is we can't give this phone our recommended stamp of approval. But in plain English, everybody read, we can't recommend iPhone 4. They turn that into, in just in plain language, Consumer Reports says, don't buy the iPhone 4, which is definitely not the case. And in fact, Consumer Reports has a separate stamp, like the red badge of shame called don't buy.
Right.
And they give it out like, I don't know, like three times a year. You know, like your product really has to like burst into flames to get it. But there were literally headlines then across the country the next day that said, Consumer Reports, don't buy iPhone 4.
Right.
And that, you know, people trust Consumer Reports. And that sounds horrible. That really sounds terrible. That says, you know, Consumer Reports, don't buy iPhone 4. CNN.com then the next day put up a thing that said, fix your iPhone 4 with duct tape. Right? I mean, and this is totally. Now
you could blame Consumer Reports for that because they went on the Today Show with duct tape and said,
right,
look,
because it makes a great demo. I mean, it's a fantastic story. I mean, you could totally see why people were eating it up. But it's really not necessary. Just by coincidence, when that story was breaking, I was on vacation for a few days in Vegas with my wife. And I happened to see – I saw a lot of people with iPhone 4s out there. I'd be waiting for coffee in the morning or going to the bar in the afternoon to get a cocktail or something like that, take out my iPhone. There'd be a guy next to me with an iPhone 4. And you know, and we'd say, hey, how you doing? You know, and are you having problems? People had no idea who I am. It's not like, oh, there's John Gruber. They're just, hey, another guy with an iPhone. And they'd say, hey, you having problems with the antenna? And I'd say, nope, you. And they'd say, nope, you know, this is, you know, over and over and over again. Or people who didn't have one yet and saw me with mine out, you know, and they would say, hey, is that an iPhone 4? How do you like it? And I'd say, I love it. And they'd say, you know, what about that antenna thing? And I'd say, I don't know. And I'd hold it, you know, put it in my left hand and, you know, didn't drop any bars, and they'd say, weird, why is everybody saying it, you know?
Wait a minute. You're saying it doesn't drop bars? Because every iPhone I've used dropped bars. Every single
sometimes.
One.
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. Right now. I mean...
It drops bars. It drops. I can't believe you're not having that experience. I do think probably you're in a very strong signal area. But
yeah, well now,
and by the way, I don't equate dropping bars with dropping calls, and I don't care if it drops bars if it doesn't drop calls. In my case, I drop calls to the point where I couldn't use it anymore.
Well, it is different. I will say that it's different with the new software update where the bars are rejiggered.
Well, but the bars is not the point. I mean, who cares?
Right. But I'm just saying for the little, like, you're in line for coffee and someone comes up and ask you for a 30-second demo of your iPhone 4. It almost never, ever does it for me.
Really?
No, it really doesn't.
It must be geographic then. Andy, does it do it for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty reliable. I felt as though Apple missed the mark a little bit during the press conference by equating the problems that the iPhone 4 is having with the problems that every single other phone has. I don't think it's the same thing. I do have...
Oh, boy. And Nokia and BlackBerry were very quick to say, not us.
Yeah. It was a mistake on a couple levels. For one, it really does. He should put up a slide saying, "Nokia, please produce videos proving that I'm just full of crap here."
Yeah,
because I mean,
he basically asked for it.
He wasn't attacking other products, but that's an opportunity for HTC, Nokia, Samsung, everybody to say, "Well, here is a shot of our phones not doing that." But for me, the difficulty is that it's such a different type of problem with the iPhone 4. If I hold it in a way that is natural for me when I'm just checking my email or just waiting in line someplace, wanting to just check out some news feeds or something, it's easy for me to hold it in such a way that I can't get a signal, I can't get communications elsewhere. It's also very easy for me to hold it in a way that problem does not occur. But the thing is, though, when I'm doing this with, again, the Samsung phones, the HTC phones, I can hold it in such a way that I will lose a bar or two, but it will never be so dramatic that the difference between holding it like this and holding it like this is that I can get a signal like this, I can get nothing like the other way. So I think it was Glenn Fleischman who said it best, that in retrospect, and they could only really realize this in retrospect, the best thing for Apple to have done, if they had the benefit of knowing about this a few months in advance, during the rollout, simply saying, "We've got this great new design that puts the antenna back on the outside, because when you put it on the inside, you automatically lose two bars of coverage. There's no way around that. So we put it on the outside now. And here are the tests in which we show that every single situation, it will give you better coverage, better situation, especially in dodgy areas. You couldn't get a signal. You couldn't make a phone call before. Now you get a good, solid two bars of coverage. Now, of course, there's only one problem with that, is that by putting it on the outside, there is this one place right here that if you touch it, maybe you'll lose some signal for technical reasons. But, of course, we put this little black bar here so you know where that is." So just know that.
I mean, I'm a lefty, and I do hold it that way. I think one of the things Steve said that I thought was a little bit disingenuous is, well, by putting the black bar there, we really just gave them a place to look for the error and try it. But, you know, this is how I hold my phone. I'm sorry. I mean, it's just how I hold my phone.
I mean,
about bars. I don't. It's fine if the bars drop. I'm not looking at the bars saying, oh, they're dropping. I don't think that's the story. And I think if the media did misrepresent it, it would be that, well, they equated bars dropping with something else. But if you drop calls, and I drop calls way too much, more than on the other phone, then it's not an acceptable phone. That's, to me, all that matters. Do you drop calls?
Yeah.
Do you drop calls?
Oh, yeah. I'm giving up the iPhone. I can't use it. I've dropped. But the final straw was dropping a single call five times and five different calls in 2 days. I'm using an Android on Verizon that I love.
Okay, but here's my question. That now, number one, it is literally
even
a case,
case
of, and here's where the zoom lens comes in.
Yeah,
it really is a difference between if I hold it like this, I lose signal. Right. If I hold it like this, I don't lose signal. So that to me is not that big of a difference. Also, right. If I put it in any kind of a case, the problem goes away completely. And the other advantages of the iPhone 4 are so great, including better coverage, better reception in every other usage consideration. And we're not even talking about the camera. We're not even talking about the 4 to 10 times greater download upload speeds. We're not even talking about the better Wi-Fi. We're not even talking about the better GPS, on and on and on and on. I'm simply not willing to get rid of a phone that's this fantastic because of a problem that is so easy to not encounter.
Well, clearly you're not alone. As Steve pointed out, the return rate on the iPhone 4 is significantly lower than that on the iPhone 3GS in the same time period.
Yeah, I will double back though and just say that I totally agree with Andy there. Jean-Louis Gasset had his own hypothetical. Here's what Jobs could have said at the keynote at WWDC about it. And there was even a time, like Jobs even specifically mentioned when he unveiled the design, and he said it was the whole, perhaps you've seen this before, and you know, little joke to the Gizmodo thing, and said, look, people even looked at this and they saw these little black lines, and some of them thought it was fake because they thought, well, why would Apple put those black lines in this otherwise perfect thing? Right. Well, here's the explanation. And then the next slide was of the antenna system, and which is in fact the frame. And he talked about the advantages of this, that it's because it's stainless steel, it gives the phone increased structural rigidity. Because the antenna is not internal, it creates a lot more internal room for other things, which they have filled up with battery. So it literally, by putting the phone, the antenna on the outside,
lots of advantages,
leads to increased battery. Right. And then there's that point where he could say, but here's why the black lines are there. Don't touch. Right? And it's like,
you think
why
that would have been effective? I mean, wouldn't that just, that's...
I think it would have. I mean, I'm sure he could come up with a better way to say it than I could. I'm not Steve Jobs, but
and you have to think that they spent a lot of time. Apple's smart. They thought about these approaches, right?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, and that was absolutely the subtext of the whole tour of this $100 million lab and all this stuff is to come out and say, if you thought we didn't know, what happens when you touch that, you've got to be kidding me. And I know there's so many people out there. I get this email every single day, over and over and over again, where people say, hey, everybody knows that when this Gray Powell guy lost this phone, that it was encased in a case. And that's when they were doing this testing. So if that's how they tested them all off campus, isn't that why this shipped? Because the only testing they did outside of Apple's campus was in a case. That's really moronic. Irrelevant to the testing of the design.
it's also pretty clear that Apple's not that stupid.
Right. I mean, but that's what, but there's so many people who believe that. That's why they gave us the tour of this facility. Right. And you see what they do. I mean, and they literally run these tests for 24 hours each. I mean, one test in that thing, spinning around it with us, what if we test it with this much signal?
Right.
24 hours for each of these things.
Is the case a good solution? Given that they didn't make that statement up front, they didn't at WWDC spin it and position it appropriately. They clearly had a PR problem. Whether it's the media's fault or not, I think blaming the media, whether true or not, is not a good strategy. Nor do I think saying every other phone has this problem is not a good strategy. But in the end,
well, see, I'll
you think
let me,
so.
Let me just point two things out there. One, I think you have a very good point about whether it's true or not that blaming the media was a poor strategy. That we can come back to that. And I do agree with that. And in fact, I actually think Jobs probably shouldn't have been the guy making their case.
Maybe, yeah.
But we can come back to that. The second point, what was your second point?
That saying other phone companies have the same problem.
I actually think that was actually the brilliant part of the thing. And you can say that it's nasty and you can say that it opened them up to this. But I think the main problem they had last week, and if there was any kind of debate inside Apple of do we need to do something big? Do we need to have like a press event and have people come out here and go nuclear on this in a response? I think if there was any debate, the ultimate reason why was that the iPhone 4 was subject to ridicule. And ridicule is really, really bad PR problem.
Yeah.
They're Letterman top 10 lists.
Yep. Stewart, everybody.
Right. And effectively, and you can say that, they can plead the case that they were being serious. But when CNN puts up a front page story on their website and says you can fix the iPhone 4 with duct tape, that's the way the news media ridicules a product. I mean, they're not, that's not necessarily a joke, but it's ridicule. Right. it's, you know, it's like in politics, like when there was a week when there was during the election, last presidential election, when there was a week full of stories about John Edwards getting a $300 haircut. You know, it's ridicule. It's and it's about this
ridicule
sort
is the
of,
wrong word.
Do you think it's the wrong word?
It's completely the wrong word. Ridicule would indicate that someone thinks, wouldn't it be funny if we stuck it to Apple by doing it like by reporting the story this way? It's a legitimate problem with the phone. It's demonstrable and it affects the usage of the phone. It's also a bigger story with Apple than with other products because Apple does such a really good job designing their hardware. It's almost unheard of that an Apple product would have a problem this big and this loud, so to speak. So yeah, that becomes a very easy story to pitch and a very, very easy, especially something that's so easy to demonstrate. As someone who talks to producers regularly about ideas for doing things
they
on
love
the news.
They love the visual of that.
I'm not saying it was wrong to report.
I disagree with the term ridicule. This is one of the areas in which I thought that Apple screwed up. Is I really think that they should have done their canned presentation for 20 minutes and done no Q&A because to my ear, every place in which they kind of messed up their message and kind of diluted what they were doing was when they took questions and said things and basically pretended like the prom queen who says, "Oh, it's so horrible. It's so horrible being so beautiful and smart and loved by everybody because you'll get this sort of thing." And nobody likes it when the prom queen makes statements like that.
Even if it's true that people want to see Apple fail because they've been so successful. So you can, I mean, it's true. I understand why that's in Steve Jobs' heart, but you don't say it.
Right.
Also, and I think I agree with John in the sense that whatever word you use, and I think ridicule is appropriate, whatever word you use, Apple had a serious problem because of this stuff like duct tape, and it was so easy to... Apple did have to really take the bull by the horns because they had a John Edwards-style problem. They were...
Yeah, and I think it was effectively like if the Edwards campaign had been able to say how much other candidates had spent on haircuts, and it was similar or something
that. Would
like
have been
that.
Effective, I suppose.
It's really
maybe.
Hard thing to spin your way out of it. People were making jokes that the iPhone 4 can't even make a phone call, you know? And that was the, you know... 10-word summary of the situation.
Right.
And I think showing the other phones whether, you know, and clearly it's not the same thing that the other phones, because the antennas are internal, it's physical interference. It's a big bag of water, the palm of your hand blocking the antenna. Whereas the iPhone, which is also susceptible to that, just like all previous iPhones, is unique in that it's also susceptible to some kind of capacitance.
It's detuning the antenna because your hand becomes part of the antenna.
Right. But their argument, more or less, and I think they could have made it more clearly, though, is that while it's technically different, it's effectively the same. That if you put your hand on a certain spot in a certain way, you lose.
I did hear them say.
That's where I thought they blew it. Again, I have, you know, I don't have the big spiky anechoic chamber in my house here, but I do have, you know, five or six different working phones from three different manufacturers. And when you test the problem of, well, do certain phones have dead spots? That's something that I can demonstrate. And usually it's by saying, well, here is an HTC phone made 2 months ago. If I hold it like this, my signal degrades slightly, and because it's an Android phone, you can actually figure out exactly how much, and it's a significant percentage, but I can still get my email with it. If I want to make sure that my email client will just completely hang because it can't get a signal, I just got to just sandbag it completely. I have to really work hard to cover up enough of that antenna so that it's dead to the outside world. My difficulty is that's not the same situation as what I personally had been seeing with the iPhone, where, again, hold it one way where there's enough contact in the meaty part of your hand and it's dead. Put a little bit of gap there, and it's perfectly fine. So that's the only place where I had a major disagreement with the way they did that, because by equating it to an unsolvable engineering problem that affects every phone equally, that's the one place where you can't point to the numbers and say, no, I don't agree with that. What you said in this presentation does not agree with what's happening outside of the presentation room.
And they did open themselves up to further ridicule the CEO's, Nokia's people said, and this is ridicule. Well, if there is an antenna design issue versus how it look and feel, we're always going to go with a better antenna.
And that's that was subtle ridicule saying Apple's always going to go for the cooler.
And the natural thing to say back is, yeah, we knew that just by looking at
just look at the Nokia phone and you could tell that's absolutely
easiest joke of the week. Easiest joke of the week.
We're willing to trade 20% of Apple looks for 10% of Signal. Yeah.
No, and then, you know what though, but that's not true either. I think all of those companies that respond, I think all of those companies should have just kept their mouths shut, man. I think they should. When somebody else is having a problem, I think you let them dig their own hole and you just look the other way.
Oh, it doesn't hurt BlackBerry or Nokia that they responded, does it? Or HTC?
No, because I think that's a dare to people to make videos with their phones.
That's true. And we have really seen quite a few.
I think you just stay out of it and let it be said. Because here's the thing. At that point, it was only Apple had shown these videos, right? And everybody knows, obviously, Apple is not the most unbiased source of information about the reception of Nokia and BlackBerry phones, right? So it's somebody who's everybody, even, even the most strident Apple fan is going to know that Apple isn't exactly the best unbiased source of information for reception of competing phones.
Right.
But by stepping into it and saying...
Now you're inviting a landslide.
I think when somebody else is... When your competitor is having... And this goes for tech, it goes for any industry, it goes for politics. When your competitor is having a PR problem, you just stay away. Don't say anything. Just say, hey, I got no comment on that.
So the case, good free cases, free bumpers, good solution... Refunds on bumpers. I mean, I think Apple actually went. Yeah. That was about as good as you're going to get. You're not going to get a recall, I don't think.
No, because that would have been absolute. No reason to. And also, that would have been absolute death. You do not come back from a recall.
Right.
That's something. Yeah. That's something you do. It's something I said a couple of times, first on a blog and then elsewhere, where barring the presence of video of adorable baby dolphins struggling for air because they're covered in spilled iPhone 4s, Apple was not going to take that extreme step.
No, I think you're right.
And there was no one was being killed and was an easy problem to work around. So there's no need to do that.
And it really shows the difference. It's one of the it's like the flip side of the difference of Apple's strategy. So Apple, very different than almost every single one of their competitors. Maybe the closest is Palm. Bets big with one new phone per year.
That's a good
iPhone
point.
4 is the new thing, and clearly internally they are set up for one new phone a year.
They got to live with that for a year. You're
so
absolutely right.
If RIM had to recall the BlackBerry 9650, right? It would be a big deal. It would be bad press, but that's one phone and it's on one carrier. It's not at all the same as, even if it's their best new phone, their single bet, the top of the line new phone. That's not like if Apple had to do it. I mean, Apple, I think they reap tremendous benefits from this strategy. But on the other hand, they also are this shows you that they're taking a tremendous risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's you definitely see that in phones like the Droid X, which has just huge software problems with it that are evident. The very first time you charge it up and try to activate it, you just see the chugginess of the UI, certain buttons that just don't work, although bloatware
I haven't had that problem. You've had problems.
I've had it for a few weeks and I haven't finished my review yet because I'm trying to figure out how much of it is really a problem and how much of it is something that I'm willing to do consumer reports all over the designer's butt about it. Just when you have the unlock screen, for instance, I'm walled in by lights and screens right now. Or else I'd go up and get it for you. Yeah. When I hit the unlock screen on an iPhone, you're used to, you get a full slide from left to right and a click saying, okay, you've done that. Great. Let's start using your iPhone.
I'm using this other lock screen. So I'll turn that other one on.
But on the Droid X, it will suddenly jump about one third of the way. And that's its way of saying, okay, you don't have to continue swiping. We understand you want to unlock it. That's good enough for us.
Right.
And you really want to see that smoothness of work. A couple of weeks ago, I took a nice long walk through Boston with five different camera phones and a real camera shooting the exact same scene six different times to do sort of a photo comparison. And the Droid X by far was the biggest pain in the butt to get that camera application working properly. It has a dedicated picture takey button on the top of it, which is something I actually wish that the iPhone 4 had, since it has such a really great thing. But there's just no point in taking the Droid X out of your pocket and trying to take a picture.
It's very slow to get the camera to run.
It will take at least 15 seconds for it to do anything. Yeah. And you can actually take the picture faster if you manually launch the camera app. And then it's just, oh, dear.
But there's some nice features in it. And it's an excellent camera. I have to say, I've been very happy with the camera.
It's an excellent camera. It's not as good as the iPhones. The light is way better than the iPhones LED light. Yeah. I mean, it has a lot of good things to recommend about it. That's why, again, I didn't want to rush out with first impressions about, oh, man, this software. Especially when you talk about software that can be fixed with an upgrade, especially when you consider that Android 2.2 is coming out soon. But to go back to John's original point, the fact that this is not a Waterloo situation. It's certainly not a Waterloo situation for Verizon. It's definitely not a Waterloo situation for Google, because if you have one phone with a lot of bad problems,
another one comes out.
It's just another bad phone.
Yeah. Uh oh, did we lose you, Andy? You started to break up. No, you're still there. Good. Okay,
I'm still here.
Yeah. No, that is a disadvantage. Apple's got this kind of crown jewel once a year, and that's it. I think Apple's response with the case is sufficient.
I think it solves
the problem. In fact, I think in some ways it may be more generous. They're giving refunds to people who bought bumpers previously. They didn't have to do that.
Right. I mean, it's also, I thought that they missed two opportunities, though. The morning of, I basically went through, here's what I thought they were talking about. I did definitely think that they would spend some time talking about putting that problem in the context of the entire phone. Like I said earlier in the show, there's a huge laundry list of great new features with the iPhone 4, including the feature that it actually gets much better signal than the 3GS. So I really thought that they would say, well, take a look at the entire phone and see if this is such a big problem that you're not willing to simply adjust the phone one half of a centimeter in your hand or put it in a case, which is something that you probably should do to protect your $200 investment. But the other thing that they should have talked about is Apple's customer service. I'm preparing a story right now about there's things that they are legally obligated to do for their customers by virtue of the warranty policy that they have attached to all their products. But then there's the tremendous amount of latitude that Apple gives Genius Bar, Apple Store managers, and even Apple Store employees to make customers happy. And this is actually backed up in ways that are pretty surprising. I mean, my advice, I haven't finished researching and writing this yet, but honestly, my advice is that if you have a new anything, especially if it's a mobile device like an iPad or an iPhone, and anything happens to it within the first 2 weeks, don't even stop to think, oh, well, geez, they're not going to replace this because something unfortunate happened to it. Chances are they're not going to replace it for you, but all I'm saying is it's worth coming in to see what they're going to say about it. I was actually as a little test case after I did as I'm embarrassed to have to admit over the past couple of weeks, I did drop one of my loaner phones and broke it on the first day. And I was trying to find out. And of course, I took it back to the Apple Store and they just swapped it out immediately. And I thought that I was either getting this belongs to Apple, so obviously we're going to replace Apple's property with a brand new phone. And failing that, I thought this was this guy's writing reviews, so we want to make sure that he has a really good positive experience taking this phone back. So as an experiment, I just put a call out to Twitter primarily to get more information about people who have dropped their phones. Did it break? Did it not break? If it broke, what happened? Was it the screen? Was it the back glass? And so I started talking to about 12 or 13 people who had dropped and broken their phones. And two or three of them had been fairly recent. And I said, just for fun, why don't you just go back to the Apple Store and explain what happened? I won't tell you to do anything. I'm saying just for fun, go back there and see what happens. Both of them got their phones swapped out.
Wow. That's pretty good. You don't see that.
They weren't making a wacky YouTube video and that's how they broke it. It was just accidental where they're like me. I was just like sort of fumbling with it on a table at a restaurant. It just slipped out of my hands. So obviously that's not a warranty issue. They're not legally obligated to do that. But Apple is really, really good at making sure that if you buy an Apple product, you will have an Apple
store. They're not so good at telling me where to get my free case, though. Do you know where
I don't think they figured it out yet.
Oh,
I mean, it's going to be on the website, but they haven't.
It's not here.
It's not here yet. So
okay,
considering that they were out of stock on all those bumper cases even before this was an issue, they got to do some real tooling up to get to make everyone happy.
I'm surprised they didn't make more bumper cases because it's got to be a $29.95 profit in those bumper cases. It's all
It's not like a Live Strong bracelet. It's actually really well made. It almost looks like when you have
Andy,
it installed.
It's a piece of plastic, injection molded.
I think it's safe to say they got $20 in profit on them. right? I mean,
it did not cost him $10 to make that piece of crap.
I didn't say it cost him $10. Also, I didn't say it's a piece of crap.
I think it's a piece of plastic that covers the antenna.
Your American Express card, gold card, is a piece of plastic. You want to give it to me because it's a piece of crap?
I'm just saying, charging $30 for something that cannot possibly, I don't know, well, let's call iSupply, could not possibly have cost them more than 50 cents.
I do agree that if you look at it, it looks like more of a $15 item, maybe a $19.99 item.
Well, anyway, they're losing all the profit because they're giving all the money back.
Now, I think that's really interesting, though. And it gets to the point of when Jobs announced it, and he's like, well, people said, so why don't you give out free cases? Fine. Free cases for everybody. And I do think, you know, the tone, I think he was being honest. I've always said this, and I thought this press conference was maybe the best example in history, that Steve Jobs is not an actor. He is a terrible liar.
He's who he is. Yep.
Now, he may tell you things that aren't true, but he believes them.
Oh, he will lie to you. He will. No, come on. Wait a minute. When he says nobody's going to watch a video on a small screen, nobody's going to want to read a book on a portable device. He's a liar in that respect.
Well, if he's talking about future products,
lying's strong. He's whatever it is business people do when they don't tell you the truth, whatever that's called.
But he's so transparent. And the whole media criticism angle of this is so overblown. It's incredible. I think those were his words. You could tell that that's what he believes. He honestly believes.
Yes, I would agree with you on that. Yeah.
And it came out. So with the case, right? And so the guy for Slate, his headline was, "Here's your free cases, jerks." Right? Yeah. That's and it's not unfair. That's sort of the way he said it, right?
That was kind of the attitude.
I've said that. I think it's going to be like a special custom bumper case that says, "Here you go, you big baby. Stop whining.
No more whining.
Happy now. And now the world is perfect because now you got a free bumper case.
Are you happy now?"
And it'll be pink with the ponies on it.
I think I know why he was peeved. I think he explained it later on when he was talking about the statistics, the hard data that they revealed. And he said, "So look, I do have to report to you that when it comes to dropped calls, according to AT&T, the iPhone 4 does have less than one more dropped call per 100 calls than the iPhone 3GS. And then he said, now I have a pet theory about this as to why this is. I don't have any data to back this up. We're going to investigate it. We'll let you know. But here's my theory. My theory is that when we sold the iPhone 3GS, there was already, because it was the exact same shape as the iPhone 3G, there was already a gazillion cases that fit it. And in our stores, 80% of people who, in the first month, who bought an iPhone 3GS walked out with a case with it. And only 20% of people buying iPhone 4s are buying a case because we can't make these bumpers fast enough. Well, there's your explanation for why they're making the bumpers, because there are no third-party cases for this, right? If they could make these bumpers fast enough, I think that they'd be selling even before the antenna gate, just because people like to buy cases for their iPhone. They had the market all to themselves, and they're selling them for $30 a pop. I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that they could have made $100 million in profit on these bumpers, right? Say $20 in profit and sell 5 million of them by the end of September, which is what they're going to give them out for. I think that is absolutely reasonable number. That's $100 million in profit. Now, to put that in context, $100 million in profit, that's exactly how much Jobs bragged that they'd spent on those fancy pants antenna labs.
It pays for the labs. Time. That's right.
Right? I mean, $100 million is $100 million. I mean, sure, they're a billion-dollar company, and they make billions every year. But part of the reason they make billions of dollars every year, part of the reason they're doing so well financially, and their results today are going to probably be fantastic, is that when there's a $100 million opportunity, they take it. You know, it's like, you know, the old thing about millionaires and you know, driving 1978 Ford pickup trucks.
Right.
It's like the reason they're a millionaire is that they're still driving a 1978 Ford pickup truck. Right. So it's take the tone of what he says. You want a free case? Fine. Have a free case. Replace free case with $100 million. You want us to give away $100 million? Fine. Here's $100 million. Now will you shut up?
Yeah.
Right? I think that explains his attitude. And that, to me, is why Steve Jobs shouldn't have been up there. I think he had to be there. I think he should have come out. He should have introduced, set the stage, and then Jobs should have come out.
I think you needed to have Steve Jobs up there because unnamed Apple vice president of marketing does not get into a 2-minute package on the primetime news or does not get onto the regular rotation on a 24-hour news station. Steve Jobs, the celebrity, whatever he says, there's whatever.
I got to tell you, though, there was huge news interest in this. In fact, our own Becky Worley, who was scheduled to cover it for ABC News, was bumped because ABC decided to send an anchor instead. I mean, and I don't know, they didn't know that Steve was going to take the stage or not. This was a big story, and I think it's one of the reasons Apple did have to take the bull by the horns and take a, you know, and have a serious press conference over this. So I can't remember Apple ever doing anything like this before, and I'm sure they pray they're never going to have to do anything like this again. And as far as I'm concerned, a case is closed. I mean, with the case, you give him a case.
I'll say that, John, you became like my ultimate hero. I was watching reading Jason Snell's live coverage. And so he was writing about how you asked the question, do any of you guys up on stage keep your iPhones in cases? And he wrote that everybody took off their iPhones.
No.
Not one of them had them in a case.
That's the only shame about this. And maybe one of the reasons they didn't sell a lot of cases is you don't want to put it in a case. It's a beautiful phone. But on the other hand, least for those of us wretches who live in poor AT&T country, if you don't have a case, you don't have a phone.
Yeah, I see. Also, I thought that was another little mistake that he made, because it's the first time he could fight this with hard numbers by saying, here is the percentage of iPhone 4s that got returned over the past 3 weeks. Here's the percentage of iPhone 3GSs that got returned the exact same period after its first release. Here's the number of dropped calls we have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I got to point out that all those numbers were useless. First of all, you don't know that people were not returning their phones because they were waiting to see what Apple had to say. And second, one more dropped call is that really doesn't have any meaning unless you know how many dropped calls the 3GS had. If it had 1 per 100, and the iPhone 4 has 2 per 100, that's doubled the rate. If it had 50 per 100, and the iPhone 4 had 51 100, it's a small increase, and yet it's still far too many. So I mean, we don't know those numbers are meaningless. We don't know.
Well, I think meaningless.
It's pretty meaningful that they were saying that calls to the Apple Care line that were specifically about the iPhone 4, a tiny percentage were about antenna and reception issues.
Yeah.
So that should show you how many people are actually having problems with it in that way.
I think I really believe that the iPhone owner is so beat down by dropped calls that they no longer even notice.
Nah. No, I noticed.
Well, I can tell you, I noticed when I went to Verizon and I stopped dropping calls. That really was a nice, breathing sigh of relief. Oh, John hung up on me now.
Off in a huff. realize that when I test out like some of these Android phones, I actually have to purge. Sometimes I have to purge my knowledge of iPhone. I'll be using this Verizon phone as my main phone for a week and a half. And if you give me the choice between not having to complain about AT&T anymore and now having to complain about this awful Android operating system and this awful HTC phone, I'll deal with a drop call every once in a while. Just please give me my iOS.
Oh, I couldn't disagree more. I am so happy with Android. But that's I think the bottom line on that is, and this is, I think, good news in the long run, you have a choice now. And you can choose your carrier. Say, I want this carrier. And there are good phones, very good phones. And I would say, I know you disagree, but I would say phones equal to the iPhone or better. I think Android's far superior at this point to the iPhone. I'm sure John would disagree too, but
I definitely agree that Android is now performing at the same level as the iPhone 4, and that's been true as of 2.1.
It's a personal thing. Look, a phone is
2.2 is going to be a big deal. I just happen to think that in my opinion, and this is not the opinion of a user, but as someone who uses all, just like you, tries everything, I can really see the differences in the quality of the hardware and the quality of the software.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's very true about these portable devices is they are the most personal devices, most personal computing devices we have, and it's a personal choice. I'm glad there's choice. For 3 years, your choice was the iPhone or basically crap. Thanks to Apple, there are now good choices, and I'm of the opinion. And by the way, there is a Droid X update you might want to check out that just came out minutes ago. But I'm of the opinion that Android's superior. I know you and John completely disagree, but that's the beauty of it. We now have a choice, and I far prefer Verizon as a carrier, at least where I am. Enough said.
I do think there's something interesting, though, and I have like a half-written piece about it. I mean, I don't know what I missed when I was faded out there, probably something really good.
You missed me saying I like my Android phone and saying I'm so happy with Verizon because I don't drop calls.
I think that there was an interesting period up through, let's say, around the release of the Nexus 1, where Android was more or less going entirely more iPhone-like.
Right.
You know, from what their original concept was, which was very, very BlackBerry-ish. in terms of form factor and the screen size, and it wasn't about touch.
I agree.
And they spent like 3 years making it more iPhone-like. I'm not going to say that it was ripping it off. I'm just saying it was like their eyes were opened, like, wow, look at that. And it went in that direction. And I think in the last 6 months, it's very interesting because I feel like they're diverging more. I mean, just look at the physical size of it, right? So the iPhone 4 has gone smaller. It's thinner. It just feels a lot smaller in your hand. Whereas the flagship Android phones of the summer have gotten bigger.
And I like that. I love these 4.3-inch screens. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, so I and I think in terms of what it means for the market, I do think it is sort of the competition begets good things for people. Yeah. You know, the people who really do want a bigger phone
have the choice.
And there's, you know, obviously, if you watch a lot of video on your phone, obviously a physically bigger display is absolutely better. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if you watch video, if you fly a lot and watch video on your phone, on the plane, the bigger the screen, the better.
Well, other things get better too, like the keyboard. I find it much easier to use a touchscreen keyboard with just a skosh more room, things like that. Anyway, it's a personal decision, and I don't even, you know, when I talk on the radio show to the unwashed masses, if I may use that phrase, I never say, you know, this is the phone you should have. I'm always very careful to say it's a very personal choice. Here's the pros, here's the cons, here's what you might like about the iPhone, here's what you might like about the Android phone, but you got to go try it, and you've got to go make a decision. I will say that for me, the best phone out there right now is not an iPhone, and that's the first time it's been that way quite some time. But moving on to less controversial and I think happier subjects, really thrilled that Apple has donated the Mac Paint source code to the Computer History Museum. And I was looking at it. I mean, this is, you know, Donald Knuth, the great computer scientist, said that the best program ever written was Mac Paint. And a program written by the amazing Bill Atkinson, along with QuickDraw and the QuickDraw routines and the MacPaint routines in Apple Pascal and 68000 Assembler are now available for download from the Computer History Museum, and it is a thrill.
Yeah, it's also I was this is God, no, not that I have to explain that I'm a nerd by now, but
this is a very nerdy thrill, I admit.
I was just like recreationally looking at the Pascal code for Mac Paint, and it is just a beautiful thing to read through. It's not like it's heavily commented with funny like little comments in it. All the comments are really technically oriented about how well here's the default corner radius for these rounded rectangles, and here's this, but. Especially, it was really wonderful to see that kind of linear programming code again.
Absolutely.
When you look at
it's not object oriented, boy, that's for sure.
Right.
Holy
cow! Right. So you
go right to the end, and there's the main. You know, right at the bottom, calling back all the routines, and it's one file. It's amazing. Yeah. Right.
And it almost reads like a story. Like this is the story of a paint program.
Right.
And this is our cast of characters. We have a rounded rectangle, and we have a heap span. We have an address space, and our story begins by initializing the user interface.
Right.
And it's oh, good. And it was just a real treasure to read. And also, I really can't wait to see. It's in Pascal, so God knows what people can actually do with this code, or if it's going to be anything more than a curiosity. But the first person to... Some people misunderstood the last time I used this sort of a statement, so I have to clarify that the first person to create Mac Paint for the iPhone...
Wouldn't that be
awesome?
I'll
give you $10, not as your fee for writing the program, because I know your time is worth more than that, but I want to buy you at least one premium beer or three really crummy ones, because everybody, even if it doesn't work really, really well, everybody wants to use Mac Paint on the iPhone.
It's
black and white too, no color. I want.
Oh no,
I want one bit.
An exact port. Yep, with fat bits and everything.
Yes,
ma'am.
Well, now, John, you're a bit of a programmer, I think. Yes.
Yeah, a little bit.
So I think, you know, and I wrote a few Apple programs in this era. So it was really fun to see, you know, the traps that you have to make to call ROM routines and Bill's kind of comments about this crazy trap number and that. And it's just really fun to look at it. Did you get the same thrill out of it?
Oh, absolutely. It was a huge thrill. I mean, it's the sort of thing I never really, I mean, it's again, super nerdy. But people listening to the show might appreciate it.
I think anybody who's into Mac is going to love it.
It's the sort of thing that you just never thought you were going to see unless somebody likes, you know, burgled it out of Apple, you know, that you're never going to see and QuickDraw too. That's the other thing too, to have the source code to QuickDraw is amazing, because QuickDraw was the most amazing part of the original Mac system software. It was the thing, the way that it drew on screen, and it was, everything seemed so fast, and it really was a thing that nobody, it was a huge technical advantage over everybody else. No other computer could do this these sort of graphical things. And
this guy was a genius. He's a genius.
Yeah, I really do think it's like I wrote on the site, it's not hyperbole to say that as of 1984, the source code to QuickDraw was the most valuable source code in the world.
Yeah.
At least line for line.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
There's this story that they tell, I think Andy Hertzfeldt tells this in his folklore.org, about at one point towards the end of the Lisa development cycle, you know, middle managers got involved and started asking programmers to turn in timesheets every week saying how many lines of code they had written, which is just, I mean, when you think of these great artists, you know, we look back and now these are the Da Vincis of the computer era asking how many pounds of marble did you chisel this week? It's like just crazy. So at one point, Atkinson rewrites the QuickDraw stuff to be 2,000 lines faster, you know, 2,000 lines fewer to do the same amount of stuff. And he writes on his timesheet that week, minus 2,000. And apparently that was sufficient to get them to stop asking for that information.
Yeah.
Just brilliant.
There was at a Mac hack where it was a landmark anniversary of the release of the Mac. I think it might have been 15-year or 20-year or whatever. And so they had the original members of the Mac team, minus Steve Jobs, up there with like a 3-hour like discussion and just panel discussion. And there's a lot of stories about Steve Jobs that maybe are not very favorable towards the CEO. And so Bill obviously feels as though, well, I don't think that at some point he feels as though I don't think everyone's getting like the right impression about Steve. So he tells this beautiful story about how he's writing QuickDraw, and Steve says, you know what? I think you should have like a QuickDraw primitive for rounded rectangles. And then Atkinson says, oh, for God's sake, you know that we're already like, we have no room for even straight lines anymore. There's so little room in here, and we'll never use it. It'll never be important. And then Steve simply says, come on with me, let's take a walk. And we went for a little walk around the neighborhood, and he showed me license plates and traffic signs and every single place in nature where you saw a rounded rectangle. And by the time I got back, I realized, my God, he's absolutely right. This, we absolutely have to have a rounded rectangle. And I wound up the story by saying, well, and so that's, you understand that Steve has these insights, and there's a reason why he is that way. And then there's oh, that's nice, and some applause. Then another member of the team says, Bill, I don't think I ever told you, I'm the guy who had that walk with him a day before he had it with you.
Steve is nothing if not absolutely persistent and adamant and dogged in his determination, and he wins those arguments, I guarantee you. Go ahead, John. You were starting to say something about the source code.
Well, it really reads well, you know, and you read all of those folklore stories that Andy Hertzfeld collected, and you realize what incredible time pressure that team was under, amazing. You know, to ship, and how just the mountain of work they had to do. And then you look at this source code and you realize that no matter what pressure they were under, they were doing things the right way. I mean, this was, you want to talk about maintainable code. It reads, you know, it's, and you know, object-oriented programming, I think it's, you know, you don't need object-oriented programming and advanced, you know, modern languages to write source code that is very, very logically structured and just, you know, readable.
Remember,
it's even harder. I think it's a testimony to just how good these guys were that they wrote. They wrote code that was as beautiful as the software that it produced.
And not heavily commented, as you said, Andy. And yet, he always said it's got to be readable or it's
well,
it's
the
not
assembler
correct.
Stuff, though, is. The 68K assembler is really well commented. I mean, effectively, the comments are like a plain English. I think there's a lot more of the assembler in the QuickDraw stuff, but...
Yeah, they're it's interesting. They optimized the stuff, the low-level stuff in assembler. So, yeah, you had to read this. And having written also quite a bit of 68,000 assembler, it's really fun. Yeah, he's line-by-line commenting this, but you kind of have to in assembler.
Well, you should. You know, but if you read it, and it's really – but they're really, really good comments in terms of if you've ever been a programmer who has to fix somebody else's code.
Right.
The comments really aren't just like, well, my boss told me I have to comment everything. It really is – like a plain English version of what is going on.
Yep.
Yeah.
And brings back great memories of things that you had to do in the old days. And
the director's commentary on the code.
Yeah, yeah. And I've
BBEdit, by the way, still has syntax coloring for
68. I know. I have it in BBEdit at home, and it was really fun to read. I'm reading it in text edit.
As a matter of fact, I got a text message like after making that comment about an iPhone version of Mac Paint. I got a text message from Rich Siegel, like the head of Bare Bones. It's like, if only you knew someone who was writing Pascal way back then, because he's one of the guys who actually wrote the Think Pascal compiler. One of the only non-Apple ways to write software for the original Macintosh.
Well, I have two requests. One for Rich Siegel to port this to the iPhone.
I did update for him personally. I updated it to $20.
And you know what? If you give Rich a really nice watch, he's a wristwatch fan. He'll be happy. And then here's another request, and we'll see if this happens. And by the way, a lot of credit to Andy Hertzfeld, who has kept the flame alive. He with folklore.org, he was the one who made the connection between Donna Dubinsky, who founder of Palm and was on the board at the Computer History Museum and former Apple executive. She made the initial contact with Apple's general counsel. And then Andy called Steve and said, Steve, help us out. It was Andy who kind of pushed this, and finally got it donated to the Computer History Museum. One more request, Andy, if you don't mind, HyperCard.
Oh yeah,
HyperCard.
Well, actually, it's interesting though that I don't know how what limit to which it was donated, because it's still copyrighted by Apple. You see, before you download it, it says, "Oh, by the way, this is still copyrighted software." So I'm not sure if people have the right
purposes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not open sourced by any means, and I think that's a mistake if you read it that way. But
I wonder if that includes, I suppose, writing it and then giving it away would also be commercial. Also, as the people who control the App Store, you find out pretty quickly whether or not they're okay with the idea of a Mac paid for.
That's interesting.
For Apple.
All right, well, then write it for Android.
Oh, good. There you go. Leo made a funny. Leo's a comedian.
You can distribute it. Don't have to get approval.
You just answered your own question earlier. Rich likes really big, expensive watches, and unless he wants to start buying the sort of watches that I buy at the drugstore, I don't think he doesn't want to pull the
time. He's
not going
to do that one. No, okay. Anyway, Andy and Bill are just geniuses. Bill, of course, is a great photographer, now does a lot of wonderful photography, and that's his profession these days. Andy seems to have made it his, among other things, he's doing a lot of stuff. Andy's working at Google now. I think he's also made it his business to keep the flame alive and to get things like this app. These guys, absolute geniuses, and it's really great to see this and just have it in your collection. He says he had to go upstairs in the attic and find an old Lisa, and it was on one of the old diskettes or something. The story is kind of amazing that this could have been even lost, you know?
Yep.
Would be a terrible shame. So I'm so grateful. Thank you, Andy, for resurrecting this. Quite a few other Apple stories. Let's do a lightning round of stories, because otherwise we're not going to have time to get to everything and get to our picks of the week, which of course I know many of you think is the best part of this silly show. iLife 2010. Any word, John? You're pretty good on the rumor front. We're seeing on the unofficial Apple weblog that there's a book in Amazon France called iLife 2010 for les nuls, which I guess means dummies in French. Are we going to see an iLife 2010? It's been 17 months.
I don't know. I've heard nothing. That's, I mean, I can, it well, sounds I, like it's due, but I've heard nothing. I don't know.
I can answer to that because book companies, and I have specific experience with Wiley, will often put a book on the list and put a book in the catalogs that they don't know that they're going to do yet or even that they've signed yet. I was kind of unplussed to find that there was a BlackBerry Fully Loaded in the book series, because
even though you've never written such a thing,
even though I haven't written it, and they're supposed to like run all those sort of things by me before, and I found out that they and other companies will do that. They'll simply say, just in case, it makes logical sense that there will be an iLife 010. Let's put that in the catalog so that we can just cancel it later on if we don't need it. But if we do need it, we won't have to like make that sort of room. So
it's equivalent to finding an obituary for somebody who's living in the New York Times morgue.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I almost think, and just thinking about it right here, it almost makes more sense to me that the next version, even if it's announced, say, in August or September or something like that. I mean, and they don't really announce things in August, so you'd think it wouldn't be announced till September.
Right.
I think they would probably call that 2011 if they're going to.
They would. Why use 2010? Absolutely. That's right. Crazy.
I mean, I always feel like anything that happens after July, you start.
Right. After February, it's 2011. Mysterious.
So I don't know. I wouldn't read too much into that. Yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is, you know, a new.
We're due. We certainly do. There's no question about it. Mysterious new Bluetooth Apple product given FCC approval. The FCC on Monday listed a new device from Apple on their website, a Bluetooth trackpad, a rectangular-shaped device with an FCC label on the bottom, A1339. Any thoughts?
It'll be really difficult for me to not put my drink on top of it. So for that reason, I've got real problems with a wireless tablet device.
No, and you know what? They have a feature for that, I believe. Because if you look at the picture, it's like the wireless keyboard. So it's permanently right at an angle. There's like a little presumably where you put the AAA batteries or AA batteries. So it's canted, I think, that, you know, at like a 10 or 15 degree angle.
So if you
stop me before, sir.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a guarantee that if you put a drink on it, it will spill.
Right.
So that's kind of what we're looking for.
Interesting, though.
I actually put it into my snarky headline, like a thing where, I don't know, fake Steve Jobs had a thing about, it was like a rumor of Apple stuff coming the next day that I had actually heard about all of it, and he had like a thing like Gruber doesn't even know about it, and so I wrote Dan Lyons thinks yours truly doesn't know about, and then, and you know, this is all in the headline, whatever it was, a new iMac and this and a that and a this and a that, and maybe even the only mentioned nowhere else other than in this very headline, a mysterious standalone touchpad for desktop Macs,
right,
that I'm not even sure I believe myself.
And even, then, you know, the bamboo's great. I don't know if there's any demand for this or not, but, you know, just it's of interest, I guess.
It does give them like sort of a gateway to putting multi-touch on the Mac OS.
Right.
So, but we don't know whether that's just simply an idea of, gee, you know, it seems like a really interesting device to have, and it wouldn't cost us that much to make, so let's make it, as opposed to we're going to start to make the next version of Mac OS a lot more gesture dependent, and this would be a good way to get that on the desktop. So
some rumors that the HP tablet, which will obviously run Web OS if they ever release it, will support have a Wacom digitizer built into the screen, so it'll support a stylus as well as touch. Do you think that's
was
a
that
good
the
thing
HP, or was that the Palm? I thought that was the Palm. Are you sure it was the HP?
Well, Palm, HP matter. Owns Palm. They're the same now, so.
Oh, that's right.
You mean the Dell?
All right, right. Yeah,
it is the Palm, or whatever you'd call it. Yeah. It's probably not going to use. I don't know. Do you think HP will use the name Palm? I don't know. It doesn't seem like.
No.
It seems like not.
I don't know, but didn't they say that they were going to call it the Palm Pad, or was that something somebody made up?
That was something somebody made up. They said, until we have a better name, we'll call it the Palm Pad. I think it was whatever.
Oh, it sounds like a great feature. I know there's a lot of artist types who really wish that the iPad had.
That silly capacitance pen is just. It's hard. It's like writing with a cotton ball. It's just, but
it's one of those features where it would make it a lot more awesome, but it would also make it a lot more expensive.
Well, that's the question.
So,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I think that even HP is going to be of the mindset that we have a hard top of $500 for this pad, and we don't want to hit $500. We'll do it if we have to, but we want $399.
Right.
And I think that a pressure sensitive or even a stylus sensitive top will be really the first thing to go off the whiteboard.
It's an interesting thing because it opens new markets, because of people who, you know, in medicine and so forth, want to have handwriting recognition or want to have note taking, that kind of thing. So,
like, one thing that's really different about this whole mobile market, not just the iPhone and the iPad, but with the Android devices and this whole sort of, you know, if you want to call it the post-PC computer industry, is a very, very conscious, obviously everybody, not just Apple, everybody seems focused on low, low price points, right? It's not like computers at all. Like in the PC industry, you've always been able to go high-end, you know, and buy a computer that a typical person would never buy. I mean, like a Mac Pro with a 30-inch cinema display, most people would think, well, that's, you know, I should buy 20 computers for that much money. And in the old days, if you want to go all the way back to, you know, talking about that source code that was released in the 80s, I mean, you could buy stuff like that. It wasn't the Mac 2FX like a $14,000 computer?
Hugely expensive, yeah.
I mean, it was like 14.
Too freaking expensive was what it stood for.
Right, but you could do that. So, like, imagine if Apple made a $1,500 iPad, or, you know, if you wanted to, if they had like a separate, you know, here's the $500, $600, $700 model. And by the way, if you want to, here's one that's $2,000, you know, and they make MacBooks for $2,000. And you could, maybe we'd already have like a Retina display, you know, pixel size. And who
that's
knows
what I want to see. I want to see an iPad with that kind of resolution. Yeah. That would be exciting.
Obviously, the industry has obviously decided that that's really just not a profitable way to go right. with these devices. You know,
they want them to be cheap. Right. Now, Lenovo is going to be shipping its pad. They've announced now, I imagine Lenovo, given the business focus, is able to charge a little bit more. They're going to call it LePad. Not a great name. By the end of the year, you wrote in Daring Fireball about all of these pads coming out now, like January of next year. But I think we were waiting for the other shoe to drop. A lot of companies want to put out pads. Remains to be seen whether they can compete with the iPad. It took about 2 or 3 years before we saw real competition for the iPhone. I wouldn't be surprised if it takes that long on the iPad.
Yeah, and I think that actually Android has lost ground, and a lot of pad makers are going to start to really rethink their Android-based devices, because HP buying Palm totally upset the table. It just kicked one of those legs right under the table.
You're right.
My position on Android has always been that an Android tablet would be a lot like an Android phone, in that it'll be functional, it'll be very useful, it'll be less expensive, it will be more open to software and to hardware expansion, but it won't be as easy to use or as attractive in the large sense of the word as an iPad. WebOS, which I really didn't like on the Palm Pre, the only reason why I didn't like it was because I didn't like the hardware
needed
at all.
Needed better hardware,
right. And when you put that on a tablet, the more I look at it, the more I think about it, the more I think I am really itching to see what they're going to do, what HP is going to do with a tablet form factor WebOS device. So I think that I really think that's the second time that makers of these NVIDIA 2-based, Android 2.2-based tablets have had to really take 4 steps back, take another look at that big whiteboard in the conference room, and figure out what the smartest way to do this is going to be. Number one was when Apple decided to sell their pad for $500. And now that HP, the biggest manufacturer of consumer computing devices in the world, has, with one stroke, by writing one check, suddenly has the only operating system that I think can really compare with iOS in a tablet or a phone form factor. That's definitely took them into wait and see position.
And I definitely think HP has a much better opportunity. I hope they don't. I certainly hope that HP is not out of the phone game, that they're going to come back with a new round of phones too. But it's in the iPad competitive sense where they have a unique opportunity to step into a market where there's only Apple right now.
I think you guys are, though, really ignoring a key element, which is that developers who did not flock to WebOS, and there's a dearth of applications for it. You got close to 100,000 apps now on Android, 250,000 plus on iPhone, and what is it, 1,000? For WebOS, that's important.
But WebOS has had one device that flunked almost.
No, I understand, but you're coming out of the gate with nothing.
Yeah, but it doesn't. I absolutely see your point. WebOS has to be seen as a brand new thing without even the legacy of the previous year's worth of development.
Right.
But I think that the person who wants to do a Twitter client for iPhone, for iOS, but realizes that there are 40 Twitter clients on it, and there are 30 word processors now, and there are 20 different photo apps. I think there might be some interest in saying, let's be the first people to write the definitive photo editor, the definitive Twitter client for this WebOS-based HP device, especially with HP putting so much muscle behind this. They're not going to give up.
I'll tell you what the answer is. The WebOS is the BOS of the future. Android is the Windows of the future. And iOS is the Macintosh of the future. You're going to see a huge market share go to Android and Google-based phones, literally 80 or 90%. There's still going to be the people like you who want this fancy iPhone. And I think that WebOS is a BOS.
Okay, now, when you go, I'm sorry. At that point, I have to say, Leo.
No, it looks antiquated. I'm serious. It looks antiquated.
Smell his coffee.
No, this nutty. I'm sorry. I have to say, this is looking antiquated. I think Apple is falling by the wayside rapidly.
iPhone 4 looking antiquated.
You
know how much time I spent setting up lights and microphones just to hear you say that you think the iPhone 4 is antiquated?
I'll give you 3 bases. Notifications on the iPhone still subpar for everybody. What are they thinking?
I do believe the lack of widgets on the screen is hurting them. I think this it's archaic to have just this stack of icons. Yeah, you added folders. Okay, finally. Multitasking, I'm sorry, this is not good multitasking on the iPhone. They blew it totally in multitasking. And finally, things like Google Voice integration on Android put it way ahead of the iPhone.
All right, let's take them in backwards order.
We don't have to analyze
right,
it.
But I think
if you want to, we can. All right, go ahead.
Here's an interesting theory, just to throw it out there on the Google Voice. Right now, number one, I don't think anybody would really argue that there's like a pissing match going on between Apple and Google about Android. Not Apple and Google overall. And in fact, Steve Jobs.
No, it's interesting, isn't it?
He said, about kicking a company when they're up, you know, and trying to rip them down. And he was like, look at what they're, I see what people are doing to Google. Google is a fantastic company. They're a great company. Why are people trying to tear them down? He had great things to say about Google. But Android in particular is, you know, clearly there's contention there. And so I think that you could just say, look, the reason Apple doesn't want good Google Voice integration on the iPhone is that they just don't want Google phone stuff on the iPhone. But here's another idea. Google Voice doesn't work with FaceTime. People who, you know, are trying to use FaceTime and they give their Google Voice number out, it doesn't work. So what if that's part of the reason why they didn't do this is that, you know, and you can say again.
I'm also, by the way, a FaceTime denier. As long as we're talking about it.
Well, Apple obviously isn't, though. Apple obviously sees it as the primary selling feature of the device.
Stuns me. Do you see a lot of people using FaceTime? I haven't seen anybody use FaceTime.
I would use it every time I travel if my wife already had the iPhone 4. Absolutely.
You use it, Andy, a lot? You use it?
I've used it more often than I thought I would. I don't think that the iPhone, that FaceTime becomes a replacement for text messaging, email, regular voice calls. I think it becomes important that two really important people in your life have devices that can support FaceTime, and then you become the biggest fan in the world.
Well, we'll see.
Just wait until the new iPods come out this fall that have front-facing.
I think if Apple supports an open stack, as they claim they are, and others can write FaceTime applications, and more phones have front-facing cameras, perhaps.
And what happens when when you're a college student and you have this new iPod Touch and you live your whole life on a college campus with ubiquitous Wi-Fi?
Well, we'll see, because my daughter's going to college with an iPhone 4, so we'll see.
So you wait and see. So what was the one
before
that?
And then the first time she shows you like her new boyfriend and they're so in love and they're getting married and Leo's crying.
You watch too many Apple ads, Andy. I'm sorry.
And then they'll have a child and then you'll see his first steps. And then you'll buy four more phones, iPhone 4s, and give them to you. It's like a Pixar movie. It'll be that scene that just makes you think.
You like the multitasking.
I love it. I think it's great. But I think the reason you don't like it is that it's not at all like PC multitasking.
Because it's not real multitasking. And
Android is sort of evolving in the direction of being a better PC than Windows.
Yeah, that's why I think there's that analogy is very close, that Android is Windows and iOS 4 is Macintosh. And if you go spin back 10 years. And Apple, by the way, ceded its lead with the Macintosh and let Microsoft steal its thunder back in 1995. And I think the same thing is actually starting to happen right now. You know that Android phones are way outselling iPhones.
Well, I do agree with you that I think that there's going to be almost an inevitable point in which there are more Android phones out in the field than iPhones, if that hasn't
happened. We already crossed that point long ago.
I mean, but only because of overwhelming adoption.
Well, you're going to become just like we Apple fanatics in the late 80s, fanatics. Early 90s, saying, well, yeah, we're the minority, but we're the best.
I think, though, it's up for debate, though, whether, and that's you're talking unit sales. I think it's very much still up for debate whether there's going to be a cohesive developer target for Android users that is bigger than the iOS market. Because I think, you know, and I don't, it's not that I think Android is too, what's the word that everybody keeps saying, fractured or
fragmented. Yeah.
Fragmented. Yeah. But it is fragmented. And there is debate over screen sizes and stuff like that. And so,
although we see fragmentation in the iOS market as well with the iPad.
But I think that's a real difference in the Windows to Mac versus Android to iPhone analogy is that there, you know, A PC running Windows really is a PC running Windows. I mean, if you wrote something for Windows version blank, it's probably going to run on any computer with that version of Windows. Whereas I don't know how cohesive it is for Android to work.
Currently,
work like that.
You don't. The only issue is screen resolution. And that's
well,
you had and that.
There's other things too, though. I mean, it's you know we could go on and on about it, but I also think, for example, there's a really good reason why you don't see a lot of good Android games, and that's that the drawing model on Android at the OS level is really not that good. Uh-huh. Now, on the other end, Microsoft, say what you want about their user interface design, right? And I could, you know, we could really give it to them on that. But when it comes to technically to drawing really fast on screen, Microsoft has always had excellent drawing support and graphic support.
Yeah, Windows Mobile might prove to be a dark horse in this.
Right. I think Windows Phone 7, if they have something up their sleeve, if their best chance, I think, is to roll out with some killer
games,
you know, iPhone-caliber games for this.
Yeah.
And I've talked to developers. I can't say who, but I've talked to iPhone developers, you know, who've considered porting games to Android. And it really is a technical problem that, you know, like the OpenGL stuff and how fast you can just slam pixels to the screen. It's a real problem on Android. And Windows never had that. And in fact, it was the opposite, where games were and still are better on Windows than they are on the Mac.
Right.
At a technically level, not just in terms of developers going to where the market is, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think games for these things, it's a huge, huge business.
That is probably the only thing. That is the kind of a flip-flop of the Windows-Mac thing, isn't it? It is the thing where the games are much, much better on the iPhone.
I think it's interesting, though, that Android really isn't a brand on any of these phones. Because if I put three Android phones side by side by side, I can't tell you that the HTC Incredible is the same experience as the Droid X, which is the same same experience as HTC Evo, because every single carrier will outfit it with a different set of a different build and a different set of widgets and a different layout of icons.
I think that's very comparable to the PC market, where you have different. But I don't know if that's so very different. They all say powered by Google on them.
In the case of the Droid X, it really is a case of it being a very, very different kind of phone in terms of reliability and usability. You know, as I'm preparing the Droid X review, I'm thinking that I really have to say that step one of any new Android phone is delete every shortcut and every widget that comes pre-installed on it. Add it back in later on from the homepage if you really want to use it. But that makes it instantly more usable and more clear. I think it's actually the Droid X where I actually had to flip three pages before I found the browser button, the shortcut to the browser. And compare that to Froyo 2.2, where there are three buttons on the screen.
Right.
Button one for a phone call, button two for the applications dock, and button three for the browser.
Right.
And so am I going to tell people that the hardware is great, but you have to start by downloading and reinstalling 2.2 from this pirate site because it's not available yet but from the manufacturer for this device yet?
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I'm playing Need for Speed on my Android phone.
I understand you're waiting a while for it to boot up and stuff like that, yes.
Yeah, it's about the same as on the iPad. Actually, it looks pretty much about as good as on the iPad. Seems pretty responsive. Boy, this is such a crappy gaming platform. I can't understand why anybody would buy this, you know?
I mean, we'll see how many games show up for it by, you know.
Well, it is. I agree with you, John. No. And when you said that, it really hit home because it's true. There are not any good games. I don't know if it's a structural problem or if it's something else, because I've cracked my windshield, shoot, but here this game is running at a, maybe it's just that it was the early phones were underpowered, I don't know.
No.
But this is EA has made a very good port of Need for Speed that plays absolutely as well as it does on the iPhone, in fact maybe better.
Also, it should be said that phones are different from desktop machines. People don't necessarily need to have 20,000 apps. They just want to find the six that they want.
Right.
So it's not necessary. Just because the iPhone has more applications available for it doesn't mean.
Well, by the time you've got 100,000, you presumably have the choices that people want, except for gaming. I'd say there is a dearth of good games on the.
The disappointment for me on Android is that I will on the iPhone I will find almost exactly the application that I want from the 7, 8, or 9 professional apps that are available. With Android, there are two and neither of them are very good, but this one is a little bit less very good than the other. So
here's a text message I just got from a friend of mine who is listening live and. Developer of a very one of the developers of very popular iPhone games. Not going to say who, but
that's fine.
Trust me. So he says about Android, buggy GL hardware and drivers make Android a bitch to target.
That makes
Each
sense.
Each phone has different bugs.
Yeah.
I mean, so, and there is, so there is sort of a fragmentation in there, and it gets to the point where the iPhone, I keep saying the best way to think of the iPhone or the whole iOS is as an app plat or app console, you know, that what like, the stuff that Nintendo makes as a game console, the iPhone sort of a whole iOS sort of abstracts that out to the app level. Part of the apps are games, but it could be all sorts of other things. But that it's run the way that the console makers run their stuff in terms of everything from the control over the software and approval to the limited number of hardware references for developers to target. Whereas Android is evolving much more like the, you know, a pocket-sized PC. And that's, you know, it has it, both sides have it, absolutely advantages and disadvantages to both. But I think that for game developers, the similarity of the iOS to game platforms is a huge win.
Always easier to develop for one, for right. sure. Amazon Kindle sales continue to rise every month in Q2. Amazon had a great, a surprisingly good quarter for Kindle. Perhaps because they dropped the prices. They also, for the first time yesterday, sold more Kindle books than hardcover books on Amazon.com. I think we thought maybe the iPad would hurt the Kindle. Doesn't seem to have.
Right. Well, the iPhone and the iPad are both available to the Kindle marketplace. So that's not that's so. If anything, it would have helped sales. It's also it's an interesting statistic because they don't mention all books. They simply mention hardcover books. So right. those are just people. Those are just that segment of new releases that have come out the past right. few weeks that are being sold.
I think there are a lot of people who still want a Kindle. They may even have an iPad. My wife has an iPad, but likes the Kindle for its lightness and simplicity.
Absolutely. And that price is a killer. That's exactly the price where that should be.
Yep.
It needs to be not just under $200, but significantly enough under $200 that it doesn't feel like you're spending $200 for it.
Do you use a Kindle, John?
No, I do not. But it's funny because the thing that always turned me off about it was the refresh between pages.
Me too.
And it still really would. But I was always an ebook doubter. I mean, just for me personally, I just really never thought that I would enjoy ebooks. Enough. I mean, because I just love the way a real book looks. Mm-hmm. And I still do, even now that I have the iPad and I've read a ton of ebooks. But I will say that the convenience has simply won out. I mean, it's just so convenient that I do. I honestly could think I've read more books since I got my iPad total than in any, 3-month stretch? Whatever month stretch that is since I got on the internet.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
I think the key phrase is if you love books, you're not going to be happy with a Kindle. If you love reading, you're going to be ecstatically happy with a Kindle or an iPad.
Good. Right.
So if I went back in time now to before the iPad and the Kindle just came out, I guess I would buy one in hindsight because I know that I would use it.
Yeah.
And I think it was smart. I think their hardware is getting smarter. I think switching to dark plastic, which they've done for the new DX model, is obviously smart because one of the big mistakes they made with the first ones was they made the plastic lighter than the screen, right? So it only served to emphasize that the screen wasn't really white. Now that they've shifted to this dark plastic, it makes the screen, which still isn't white, look more like it's white. It's just like I just think they're getting a little bit smarter.
The digital entertainment content ecosystem. DEC. What a terrible name.
Those boys know how to market to consumers.
DEC.
I smell success all over this acronym.
They're clearly not marketing to consumers. They're marketing to the people who make digital content because they don't want consumers to pay attention to the fact that there is a new DRM in town. It's called Ultraviolet. And it does answer one thing consumers want, which is the ability to buy content once and put it on a variety of devices. If they can get everybody to go along, and they have 60 entertainment companies on board, you'll be able to buy it once and use it on a variety of platforms. Unfortunately, despite getting companies like Paramount Pictures, Warner Brothers, Sony, Comcast, Netflix, and Microsoft, no Disney and no Apple. Is that the nail in the coffin for Ultraviolet?
Yeah, pretty much. It's an interesting idea. It not only is it's DRM, yes, but the big idea is that you sort of have a central storage house for who owns what and who has permission to do what. So the idea, it's not only designed to foster purchase of digital content, but also hopefully to encourage people to get up back out there and buy more Blu-ray discs and buy more DVDs, because part of this system is that if you buy the DVD and take it home through some mojo, you'll be able to essentially, if it's under this DRM, register that, oh, by the way, that guy has actually purchased a $20 DVD of this movie, and therefore he should have access to digital copies of this wherever he goes. So on that basis, it's kind of cool and kind of consumer-y, and okay, that's interesting. But I really, you know how this will play out. You know that there'll be software updates every 3 days because some kid in Belgium found out how to break a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie from 10 years ago. That will and so basically it'll be just 3 days of every single time you boot up, they'll say, I'm sorry, I can't play this content because your DRM signature is out of date. Contact this website in order to update your keys, and it's just not going to work.
So much for Ultraviolet. We just buried it, and it just was born.
I'm glad I have that power. Awesome.
No white iPhones yet. Apparently, they can't get them white enough. According to industry sources and Engadget, the company that's making these white iPhones, Lens, can only meet about half of Apple's demand. And Apple won't sell the white iPhone until they can get them up to spec. They were hoping for a white iPhone before now. I'm not sure when the white iPhone will be available. Does anybody really want a white iPhone?
Oh, definitely. My wife's waiting for one.
Oh, I
know a lot of people who
are. Is it girls?
I know some guys who are waiting for white iPhones. They look very great. You know, I saw three of them on campus.
Oh,
I saw them when
it.
I was there for the press event on Friday. Yeah. They're all over the place at Apple. People at Apple have them. And they look great. You know what they look like? They look a lot to me. They look like the old iPods back from...
Yeah. Okay. Now I understand the appeal. It's like an iPod. Right?
The thing that I never liked, I mean, whenever I'm buying anything, a shirt, a car, a phone, anything, I just pick black. And that way I don't have to worry about it.
You're a guy. Pick black. Yeah, we want gray animals.
I picked like 15 years ago, black is my color. And if I can get it in black, I get it in black. You have it in black? All right, good enough.
You don't have to match it with anything. Of course, I'm the guy wearing a pink shirt right now, so I don't know.
The thing I never liked about the white iPhones, the 3G and the 3GS, is that the front was black. And I always thought that just looked like they took half of almost looked like something that you'd buy like third party, you know, like take your black iPhone and turn it into a white back.
Well, it's
iPhone,
this front, I think, that's hard to make. They could make the backs very easily. It's just a piece of glass. It's this front that's so
difficult. You look at the people walking around with these white ones. And I saw them at the press event when, WWDC too. Mm-hmm. Really, really looks like, to me, it just feels like a really, really thin, futuristic iPod, from 10 years ago. And it's really, I think it's a very, very nice feel to it.
One thing I will say is I think the design of the iPhone 4 is gorgeous, best they've ever done. And so
what happens, here's the thing, one of the things I'm thinking about, I mean, who knows if this report about the paint stuff is true. Sounds like that could be the holdup. Sounds plausible.
Right.
What if these white ones come out and you put your finger on the spot and there's nothing happens?
maybe that's what they're waiting for. September 30th is the end of this case giveaway. And I asked Steve about that. And he said, well, we want to keep our options open. But it did kind of imply that maybe we could... I don't know, anodize the steel, for instance, and solve the problem. And maybe, I'm sure right now they're trying all sorts of things.
There's a lot of ways to read into that. And I thought that was just another angle where it was like just not out. You know, I don't think they were, I think that you could tell that they'd rushed that whole thing. You know, just
they left too many loose ends.
Yeah, that whole explanation of the September 30th deadline. So obviously a lot of people are reading into that thinking that what he said was that by September or by October 1st that they're going to have this problem licked,
we'll
and that phones running off their production line are not going to have the problem. The other way I thought to read into it is just to go back to all the money they want to make from selling these bumpers, and that maybe if everybody is shut up by then for Christmas, then for
again.
For the Christmas buying season, which will start around October, that they can go back to making money from these bumpers. I think Steve Jobs wants that bumper money. I think he really wants it.
You know,
and that's why that. So why September 30th? I think because October is when people start buying Christmas iPhones, and if everybody is shut up by about it by then, and they can go back to selling them for $29, then he gets his $100 million in bumper money.
I think that's about the time the back to school buyers stop buying things for back to school. I think it's just an arbitrary date. At that point, they'll either decide that it's no longer perceived as an issue and they need to extend the program, or that they will have found a software fix for the problem or a hardware fix of the problem. I think that's just to say, let's not leave it open-ended. Let's just make sure that we're going to say that on, and maybe on September 25th, we'll say, okay, by the way, we're extending that to the end of the year.
Of course, then that starts the whole thing up. Oh, Apple hasn't solved the problem. They still have the problem. And so it does kind of put them on the spot. Here's my conspiracy theory. Apple left all these loose ends so we'd stop worrying about the antenna and start thinking about, oh, I wonder what is going on there. 921, Apple's iTunes 921 came out today, a maintenance update. Number of bug fixes. Nothing to read into that, I don't think. FileMaker Go. I don't want to steal anybody's pick, so I won't go on too long. But we'll allow you to run FileMaker databases on your iPad and iPhone. I like Bento a lot. I think that's a good choice for people who don't need more complicated databases.
It's another app store, really.
Yeah. It is, isn't it? A FileMaker app store. You're right. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. Because there's a ton of FileMaker apps.
Yeah.
PC World yanks the iPhone 4 from the top spot in the smartphone chart. Don't know what that means. It's kind of like the Consumer Reports thing.
Hey, how come they're getting all the page views? Right. We want to be on the Today Show, too.
Yeah, we got duct tape, too. There is somebody on Etsy selling, I think this might be a good product, the iPhone Band-Aid. It goes right on the bottom there. In six beautiful designer colors, and it's kind of cheap. It's only $4.99 for a six-pack.
But it did make me think, though, can you think about all the different case manufacturers that are going to be really cheesed off now because they've probably invested a lot of money in tooling up to design these new cases. Now they know that nobody's going to want to buy a $30 case from them if they're going to get one for free from Apple for the next 3 months.
You have to make it nicer. You can make a nicer case, a leather case.
Well, here's the thing, though. They're not just – Apple isn't just giving out its own bumpers. It's going to – because it can't make them fast enough. So they're
sourcing it from the manufacturers.
I think that there might be jostling to get in on that. I mean, and who knows what the negotiations are and what Apple's actually going to pay these third-party guys. But there, you know, if your case, if you want to, you know, if you have a low-cost case, and if Apple says, "Look, we'll give you $10 each for them," I don't know what it's going to be. You know, it might be very good for a certain number of case makers to get on that list of the free ones that they're going to give out.
Do we have a date that this stuff's going to happen? Because I want a case.
I thought they said next week, but it seemed like
I believe they said sometime late this week.
Okay.
All right.
I'll be looking for my case, man. We're going to take a break, come back with our picks of the week in just a moment, but right now, time to tell you about our picks from Audible.com. We're big fans of Audible.com, that great bookstore of audio entertainment, 75,000 strong. I am just a huge Audible fan, as everybody knows. I don't go anywhere without listening to Audible. I'm still working on the Contortionist Handbook, Andy. Haven't got to the end. Don't tell me. No spoilers.
But no spoilers.
I was listening to it on the exercise bike. I listen to different books now in different venues. It's because I have so many books. I'm backlogged so much. So in the car, I'm listening to Paolo Bacigalupi's The Wind-Up Girl, which is a great science fiction story. At the gym, I'm listening to the Contortionist Handbook. And when I go to bed at night, I listen to The Count of Monte Cristo. And that's probably what I'm going to be listening to for the next 8 years because all three of them are fairly long books. Audible has just kind of an endless supply of great literature waiting for you. Now with the iPhone app that is just stunning, stellar, they updated it. I think it's at 101 now. And the download problems have seemed to have all gone away. So if you've been having trouble downloading Audible books on the iPhone, go at it. Go at it. It's a great way to do it. 75,000 titles. You can get your first one free by going to audible.com/MacBreak. The only trouble you'll have is picking just one. That's why we have Andy and Notko with us today. Not the only reason.
Exactly.
What's your pick of the week?
My pick is a book that someone actually gave me like 3 months ago, but I didn't get around to reading until like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It's called You're Lucky, You're Funny by Philip Rosenthal. He was one of the co-creators of Everybody Loves Raymond. And that TV show was very, very successful. Leaving him with his what could be termed blank you money. And so now that the show is over and he had time on his hands, he decided, I don't really care what everybody thinks about every single TV executive and other personality I've worked with over the past 15 to 20 years of my career. And I'm a comedy, and I've just spent 10 years writing a sitcom about a writer who converts funny experiences into his column. So as you might imagine, it's a really funny, just nice story about here's what it's like to not only be a comedy writer, but also what it's like to get business done in the TV industry.
Oh, I'd love to listen.
So it's not just, and then Ray Romano he parked across two parking spaces, including the place where the ice cream truck for the sick kids was gonna go. And they told us all to go screw ourselves. And that was right. It's not stuff like that. It's more interesting stories well told. And of course, if you like stories about network executive bozos, he tells a story about how he was developing a sitcom for Peter O'Toole. And the idea of like a weekly show for Peter O'Toole, you're like, I don't even work for the industry, but I'm willing to sign you to a contract to just have him at my house doing that for 20 minutes a week. and he got a turn down from an executive who said, we'd rather not have people with accents on our network. So it's 7 hours long. I think it's a great summer book because you'll get through it like in plenty of time to be ready for back to school shopping. But it was a gift a few months ago from a friend. And, you know, sometimes you get a book and it looks interesting. You put it on the shelf and I don't know why I happened to pull it down, but I just decided to just like read it for just the first like three or four pages. And before I knew it, that was the book I was reading for the next two or three days. So it's just a funny book, really well written and a great pick.
Well, a wonderful pick. Thank you. You're lucky. You're funny. How life becomes a sitcom. Phil Rosenthal. Now that's just one of 75,000 titles. Go to audible.com/MacBreak. Sign up for that gold account. Pick your book. It plays back on all the Apple devices, including the iPad. And there's that great, as I said, iPhone app now, which really it makes it a lot of fun. Your whole library is available to you, and you can download it mostly via Wi-Fi because most of these books are over 20 megabytes. Really just a wonderful addition to the iPhone, I think. Audible.com/MacBreak. We thank you so much for your support, Audible. And now it's time for our picks of the week. John, I warned you at the beginning of the show, I've given you now like 15 hours.
Yeah.
It's a long show to think about. You know,
I've come up with a good one, I think.
All right.
So when I got my iPad, one of the things I definitely wanted to do with it is use it sort of as a, if I'm traveling, this is the computer I'm going to take. And in practice, it actually has turned out that way. Like my main computer, the one I'm communicating to you with right now, is still a MacBook Pro. But my MacBook Pro, to me now, feels sort of like a portable workstation, a fantastically portable workstation. And I do take it with me, like I took it with me to Apple last week because I was going to try to do serious work while I was out there. But I almost only ever open my MacBook now on a desk. I'm either at my desk at home or if I'm in a hotel, so I'm going to sit down and work, I'm at a desk. Anywhere else where I want to use a computer, the couch, the airplane, anywhere else, I use the iPad. But if you're going to take it out of the house like that, you need a bag. Right. And so, for example, another great instance was when I was at WWDC last month. I had my MacBook with me, but it stayed in the hotel. And all day, every day when I was actually at the conference, I had my iPad. So what bag to get? And there's, a whole bunch of people coming out with it. It's a big market. But I'm really, really happy with the one that I bought. It's the from Tom Bin, T-O-M-B-I-H-N.
Oh, I love the Bin bags. Yeah.
.com. And they call it the Ristretto. For netbooks, or now I guess they've renamed it. It's the Ristretto for iPad/netbooks. Costs $110. I, of course, bought mine in black, so it probably won't show up very well.
So it's kind of like, it looks a little bit like a backpack.
Sort of. It is, but it's a single strap, mm-hmm. and it goes over your shoulder. I bought the upgrade. I think it's like $15, or no, it's actually $30, sorry, for the absolute shoulder strap, which I think is a little... I think for a $110 bag, they could give you the nice shoulder strap with it. But it actually is, it is a nicer strap. And it's just, to me, it really, it's hard to believe that they had this out before the iPad shipped. It was originally their Ristretto for netbooks. It is the absolute perfect size for an iPad. Wait, let me just show you this. It also has a separate pouch in front. Back here is where you put your iPad. And then right in front... Zip.
There goes the keyboard. Oh, that's cool.
And it's just could not be a better height. I mean, you just it's they must have been like, they must have, it's just amazing how perfect it seems for the iPad. I love it. And yeah, it's $110. Everybody I know, I've never had a Tombin bag before, but everybody I know who has them absolutely loves them. So I expect it to be my iPad bag for, I don't know, the next 10 years. It's great. I really, really, really
like
it.
I am a big, all my laptop bags come from Tombin. I don't have that one yet though. I'm gonna have to buy that one, but I'm a big Tombin fan.
And it's just everything else you'd want a bag, little pockets for pens, just the right number, you know, not too many zipper packs, but enough that you just. Nice little pocket that fits my camera. It's just really, really a nice bag.
Great pick.
And it's just perfect for the iPad.
Love it. Andy Anatko, your pick of the week, sir.
My pick of the week is actually a book that just arrived at my house like three, four days ago. It's Photoshop CS5, The Missing Manual. Ah. I should mention that the author is a friend of mine, Lisa Snyder. As a matter of fact, I married this woman. Before you get excited, I married her to another man
I thought we had a minister. Big announcement here, Andy. Holy cow. That's like when Wozniak came on our show and said, oh, yeah, and announced that he'd gotten married. Wow, Andy. Okay. You didn't marry her to yourself.
I married her only as minister.
I see.
So I like it a lot because I'm in that really, really tough place with Photoshop where I use it and I like it, but I don't make money from it, so I'm not really motivated to learn properly. And Photoshop, for all of its complexity and its expense, is easy enough to use that you can use 75% of its most useful and popular features without reading a manual and without having to learn the right way to do anything. But there are right ways to do things, and you find yourself banging your head against the floor because you're doing something the really difficult manual way when there's actually a tool that will make things really, really easy to manage. And so it's a really well-written, well-illustrated book that takes every single, it really breaks it down into things that you want to accomplish with Photoshop. Like if you want to learn how to really use layers, there's a whole section on layers that will break it down into, well, here's a way that you want to really add a really nice add pop to a sunset behind you. Or here's a way that you want to fix a photo so that you're just affecting just the blacks and nothing else, just to give it a little bit of extra contrast. There's a section on selective blur in which she's showing you how to take a photo of someone who has like the really, really like prominent freckles and how to just soften the freckles without removing details. What I'm covering up is that she's also on the opposite page. Here's a guy with like a kind of a big butt. And so here's a lesson on how to reduce just the size.
Reducing butt size. That's the page
exactly.
I want.
Yeah. I was leafing through it because she actually showed me a personal photo that she had used that I was actually in from one of the parties that we were at. So I was trying to figure out if I was actually in one of these. I think her editor said that no, people do not want to see this in a book that costs $29. I'm sorry, $49. But it is very well done. Again, it's over, just over the past 3 or 4 days, I'm editing like about 100, 200 different photos because I did something kind of arty a couple of weeks ago at the Public Garden. And now I'm like, oh, I'm not just taking snapshots here. This one is a photograph. I need to treat it accordingly in Photoshop. And every time I get into the point of, dang it, how come I really want to just duplicate this section and patch it over this section of railing so that we don't see that stupid piece of graffiti. But I know how to do it, but it's not coming out well. And then I simply actually read up on how you would actually do that in this. And I realize that, yes, Andy, the reason why you can't do it correctly is because you're an idiot. But this will make you less of an idiot. So for God's sakes, you already spent hundreds of bucks on Photoshop, $50 for a manual that actually shows you how to use it and how to actually get more use out of it than you would out of a $100 shareware photo editor, I think is a good buy. Again, I really like this a lot, so that's why I'm recommending it.
I just upgraded, so I'm going to get it because I need the manual because it is missing.
My problem with Photoshop is that I feel like I really, really mastered like Photoshop 3.0.
Right.
Exactly.
And I felt like I knew like almost everything there was to know about it, and I could really do stuff. And then I'm like you, like I don't really need it on a daily basis. And then here it is, like, you know, 11 years later or 10 years later, and it's like I'm still doing things the Photoshop 3.0 way. And now there's like a button, like you want to like cut somebody's head out from the background. It's like, it's dum dum, just click this button. And I'm like, oh my god, I was like zoomed into 8,000% and doing it pixel by pixel like I used to back in 1993.
is incredible because this has been updated for CS5. I think this is the second edition of her version of the Photoshop missing manual. And I'm leafing through and I'm like, wow, I didn't know that. Because I'm also scanning in like old prints and old stuff from Ida. Wow, there's a new feature where you don't have to like individually scan each one and then straighten it. You just slap them all down on the flatbed and press the scan button and it will automatically find all those square corners. And wow, that's great. That's a great CS5 feature. Oh no, that's actually been in there for quite a while. I just never actually knew about it. Okay, good to know. Thank you, Lisa. You know, the first time you use the layers tool properly, the first time I showed someone how to use the layers tool so that, yeah, instead of actually like making a destructive edit to lighten the background, here's a way to do it so that you can then 2 days later decide that, no, actually, that was a stupid thing to do. I want to make it a little bit lighter than that. And because you use an adjustment layer instead of actually using the burn and dodge tool, that nice big tool with the big icon on the tool palette, you realize that, that was $50 well spent. Again, well done, Lisa.
Well, thank you for that pick. My pick is an iPad. Oh, we lost John again. Should I call him? I'll get him. What the heck?
He has to join us in that big kick line at the end of the show.
At the end. Da, 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 da. There's no business like Mac business.
We've had a lot of fun, but now we are done. So here we say goodbye from Twit.
My pick is the ill-gotten spawn of two former Bing engineers and an ex-Google News staffer. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what would come of that?
Wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Yes. I got John back. There we go. This actually, though, is very cool. It's called Apollo. It's a news reader for the iPad. You know, I'm always looking at different news readers on the iPad, mostly because the iPad is such a, you know, a great place to read news. This has an interesting idea. It starts you out with some feeds, but then watches what you read, and then as you read things, starts to recommend new sources and new content, so helping you kind of discover new stuff. I guess my web is loading a little bit slowly here. So we're seeing a lot of news readers that have the kind of this metaphor of the scroll. You know,
right, Google Reader just added that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They added a new reader feature that I really like that kind of is a slideshow thing. We talked a lot before about Plus, and so this is a kind of similar idea. But I think what's going to be interesting about this is how it adds new content based on the stuff that you read or pick. It's a very nice, easy-to-read layout. If I have any objection about it, and I object about this on a lot of these, is it doesn't have Delicious. It has Facebook, Twitter. Mm. You can email links. I wish every newsreader would include Delicious. Maybe we're the only people still using Delicious. I suspect that might be part of the
Delicious
problem.
Delicious and Instapaper.
And Instapaper, yeah. Now, you got to have Instapaper. That's something I'm sure that they'll add. You can favorite these. You can thumbs up and thumbs down it. You can see if I'm reading this story, Supreme Committee approves Kagan for Supreme Court, I can click this button for related, and I can see related stories. So it starts to give you, well, it's almost like a web-like experience of cross-linking and browsing. I think it's very pretty, and I'm very interested to see what they do. They are calling it the newspaper of the future. TechCrunch says it will deliver the final blow to the newspaper industry, but I don't know if that sounds like hyperbole. $2.99, brand new
from
on
TechCrunch.
Yeah, hyperbole.
What?
Huh? What? What a shock! But I like it a lot, and I'm you know, if you look at my iPad screen, you'll see that I have a ton of different news readers on here. I can't decide, you know, a NewsRack, Reader, Pulse, SkyGrid. All of these have been recommendations on MacBreak Weekly at one point or another.
Yeah.
I think that news readers on the iPad are what Twitter clients were for the iPhone.
Yeah.
When the app worked over, which is the leading playground for like just messing around with the ideas of what the UI should be like.
I mean, that's a very good point. So it's where you're starting to see so much innovation now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean the obvious way to do it is sort of to make it look like Apple's iPad mail app, which is what, you know, use NetNewsWire a lot on the iPad, but that's sort of
that as well. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's sort of like the obvious way to go with just a column of sources on the left and you click on a source and you get the items on the right and it fills in. We're seeing a lot of stuff. You know, I hadn't seen this Apollo before. It looks great.
Yeah,
So many of these feed readers, and they're very, very, very original takes. Lots of original UI design work.
I love Pulse. Great. I really love Pulse, and I'm glad that survived the New York Times takedown request. Yeah. Eddie, you're showing something there. What did you want to say?
Oh, no, I was just showing NewsRack. which is my favorite reader. I was just saying that I've had sort of a like I love the fact that no matter how long I've been writing about technology, I still have these I'm so glad that I live in the 21st century moments. And I was having one of those moments at Panera Bread yesterday or the day before, because I'm just on my iPad and I'm looking at all these news, going through my daily news from 100 different sources. And every time I'd hit an article that's a little bit too long for me to read while I'm at Panera Bread, I tap one button to send it to Instapaper, and immediately it becomes an ebook that I can read whether I'm online or not. And I realize that this is something that I could never have imagined existing 5 years ago, either these services or the device that I'm really using it on. Or I would get like 50% of what the system works, how the system works and what it does. And it really is the case study of, you want to explain to somebody why a tablet form factor, and especially an operating system that really works well and can create beautiful software, why you would spend $500 for a device like this. I really think that it's a newsreader that shows off the iPad to its ultimate advantage.
We're getting early Apple quarterly results in. I guess the call began right after the close of the stock market, which was 25 minutes ago. Apple posts Q3 price per share, or earnings per share rather, of $3.51, revenue of $15.7 billion, exactly what the analysts said, above the Apple predictions. So it looks like it's very close to what people thought. Shares go up on this news quite a bit, 3.2%. So there you have it, the latest earnings coming out right now as we speak from Apple. There's John Gruber. John, we're going to let you go. We called you back to let you go.
All right. That's very nice of you. I love that. That's life on AT&T, too.
It's always great to talk to you, John. John Gruber is really the blogger you got to read if you are following Apple. Or frankly, if you're following anything that's going on, your little snippets, your snarky little comments are a must read on every newsreader I have. DaringFireball.net. And by the way, that Bill Murray interview was fascinating, wasn't it?
Man, he's the best. Yeah, he really is.
Just really, really good. But anyway, this is, so you see, he talks about all sorts of things. DaringFireball.net. We'll get you on again real soon, John. Enjoy your day.
All right, man. Thank you. This is great.
Great to talk to you. Andy Iannocco is, of course, the tech guy at the Chicago Sun-Times, and his blog is www.cwob.com. Any new books out you want to plug?
I'm going to have a whole bunch of them at the end of 2010 and start of 2011. Unfortunately, I think my production schedule really starts to crank in overdrive starting in like 3 days from now. So it's going to be fun. The iPad book should be out by the time you're ready to find out how to spend all that holiday money.
Aha! Good timing. Thank you, Andy. We'll see you again real soon. Thank you all for joining us. You can watch us do this show every Tuesday morning, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC, right here at live.twit.tv. And then download audio and video from twit.tv/MBW. Of course, iTunes has it and all the other podcast aggregators. We thank you for being here. We'll see you next week on Mac Break Weekly.